You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
We are laughing. And we are very good friends. Good buddies sharing a special moment.
You don't say anything wrong. You know, just let it happen.
Laughing and enjoying our friendship. And someday we'll look back on this with much fondness.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, Josh, but I look back on Anchorman with a fair amount of fondness.
Anchorman is kind of a big deal.
But how will Anchorman fare in this week's top five 21st century comedies?
Might want to bring a trident. That top five could escalate quickly.
Oh, man. A week after mourning the passing of Gene Wilder, we will also remember the comedy legend with a Sacred Cow review of 1974's Young Frankenstein. That and more. Ahead on Film Spotting.
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits?
In the reef!
Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh. I'm Adam. A couple weeks back, the BBC published its list of the top 100 films of the 21st century, not a list they just came up with randomly. Josh, they actually had almost 200 critics submit their list of the top 10 films of the past 15 or so years, and this is what they came up with. We will get to some of those picks, and we'll talk to one of the people who submitted a ballot a little bit later in the show. But other than movies like some of the Pixar films, WALL-E, Finding Nemo, Inside Out, and Ratatouille, and some of the Wes Anderson movies like The Royal Tenenbaums, Moonrise Kingdom, and The Grand Budapest Hotel, all funny movies, all definite comedies, but not necessarily the broadest comedies, not necessarily comedies that you would think of in the same conversation as Anchorman, like we started off the show with.
Pure comedies.
Pure
ones
comedies.
They're going directly for laughs, trying to hit you that way first.
That's it. So we are going to share our favorite pure comedies from this new millennium here a little bit later in the show.
But first, we give the Sacred Cow treatment to what is easily one of the best comedies of the 1970s, Young Frankenstein.
But wasn't that the whole basis of your grandfather's work, sir? The reanimation of dead tissue?
My grandfather was a very sick man.
But as a Frankenstein, aren't you the least bit curious about it? Doesn't the bringing back to life what was once dead hold any intrigue for you?
You are talking about the nonsensical ravings of a lunatic mind. Dead is dead.
But look at what has been done with hearts and kidneys.
Hearts and kidneys are tinker toys. I'm talking about the central nervous system.
But sir,
I am a scientist, not a philosopher. You have more chance of reanimating this scalpel than you have of mending a broken nervous system.
But what about your grandfather's work, sir?
My grandfather's work was doo-doo. I am not interested in death. The only thing that concerns me is the preservation of life. Class is dismissed.
As part of our celebration of the work of the late Gene Wilder here in the show, we added an extra poll question at filmspotting.net asking listeners to name their favorite Gene Wilder performance. Leo Bloom in The Producers, Willy Wonka from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, Jim from Blazing Saddles, Dr. Frankenstein from Young Frankenstein, or the option of Other. We might as well share the results here, Adam, as we get into our Young Frankenstein Sacred Cow review. Other was in last place with 2%. Leo Bloom was next with 6%. Then Jim from Blazing Saddles with 13%. Then very tight here at the top. But Dr. Frankenstein won out with 40% of the vote. Willy Wonka got 39% of the vote. So really, really close there.
That's Frankenstein. I just wanted to get that first one in.
Well, depends at episode. What point in the movie we're talking about.
Fair, fair.
He makes a major change there. We heard from Stephen from Amman, Jordan. He shared this note along with his vote. I really wish I could have voted for Leo Bloom. It was his first collaboration with Mel Brooks, which in turn became one of the best actor-director collaborations in film history. It would be easy to say Willy Wonka, which is likely his most nuanced role. And it's the role generations grew up in learning to love him. But my vote goes to Frederick Frankenstein. It was Wilder's film until Brooks took it up to gain a co-writing credit. Wilder is crazy, clever, silly, dapper, absurdist, intelligent, and even romantic in the role of the doctor who creates life. He's at his comedic peak here, creating some of the best ever on-screen jokes. Not least of all is the entire putting on the Ritz sequence, which even Brooks famously discounted at first, believing it to be too whimsical to be in the film. Wilder fought for it with such gusto that Brooks conceded, and we're left with a sequence that is often pointed to as one of the funniest moments ever put on celluloid. Because of his passion, because of the humor, because of the memories, this is the role that I will pull clips from to remember his legacy, that I will show my kids to help them understand what comic genius is. So let's start there, Adam. As I know you had planned to watch Young Frankenstein with your kids. It was, in fact, on your list of the top five non-kids movies to show your kids earlier this summer. So how did Wilder's comic genius go over?
It went over pretty well, actually. I knew that the two youngest, that's a six-year-old and a nine-year-old probably.
Sure.
We're going to need something a little livelier, something a little more cartoonish. And so we went ahead and excused them from the room. But I did watch it with Holden and Sophie. I've mentioned them a few times here recently on the show, 14 and 12. And I'm always nervous, especially when it's a black and white movie because they're dumb kids sometimes, and if they don't think it's modern enough, they aren't that into it. I tried to watch some of those Marx Brothers movies with them, and they weren't having it. They were
You can't blame them for that.
See, I wasn't going to force you down that path, Josh, but of course you hanged yourself. But they didn't get into those films at all. Of course, you're right. We didn't really either, but they were pretty active in their disdain. That was a few years ago, different kind of comedy, and I was very happy and relieved to see Holden and Sophie as engaged by Young Frankenstein as they were. And we can get into some of the funniest bits in the movie and how they reacted to that maybe as we get into the review. In terms of talking about what makes Young Frankenstein so good and in terms of whether or not it is a sacred cow, absolutely deserves its status as a sacred cow. I love getting an email, first of all, from Stephen all the way in Jordan. That's always fun to get listeners from that far away. But he nailed it in terms of what makes this movie so good and what makes Wilder so good. And Mel Brooks is a genius, and there are a lot of geniuses at work in this film, but I don't know if it didn't have Wilder in that central performance. And all those things Steven said, how crazy, clever, silly, dapper, absurdist, intelligent, and even romantic he is, that's all on display, and that's a tall order. And in terms of that pull, it'd be tough for me just because of my nostalgic love for Willy Wonka. And I think we see a lot of those same traits that Steven just described come through in Wonka as well. That's probably how I'd go. But I wouldn't begrudge anyone who thought this was Wilder's best performance.
Yeah, I just had a listener on Twitter as I was about to head out to come do this recording ask, well, Young Frankenstein or Blazing Saddles, which would you go with? And I think for the things – he is great there. But for the things that Steven talked about, it's Wilder's creative presence, not just as an actor, but throughout this movie that you can feel. Him being the co-screenwriter and being so heavily involved in this project that I think does put it slightly ahead of Blazing Saddles for me. Although tomorrow I could change that and go with Blazing Saddles because we did a Sacred Cow review of that as well. And it retained its Sacred Cow status as Young Frankenstein should for me. Adeline had homework to do, so we watched it with Bea, who's about to turn 11. And, you know, she took much of it way too literally. Kids can take comedies like this, you know, at face value, especially she's a budding naturalist, so she got caught up in a lot of the science stuff and how that was supposed to be working. But overall, she did like it and really enjoyed the slapstick sequence with Gene Hackman as the blind man trying to serve.
So good. Did you recognize him?
Oh, yeah.
Be honest.
Well, I remembered that.
Okay.
I mean, I remembered from seeing it. Yeah. And he's pretty recognizable. You know, there's not that much costuming going on, and his cadence and the way he delivers it. Oh, he's so funny, though.
He is so good.
So funny. And just what's going on with the soup and the coffee there. Great bits that B did appreciate. And yeah, I think obviously we're watching this with a lens focused on Wilder because of his recent passing. But again, he is just the key to this film. We'll get into the excellent supporting cast, I'm sure, as we've already alluded to a few of them in Boyle and Hackman. But I loved watching him and not knowing when he was going to play it straight for laughs, because he could still get laughs that way by just, you know, a glance or not doing anything, because we associate him with those blow-ups, right? So sometimes when he doesn't do anything, that can be just as funny. But then, of course, there are those moments where he goes for the jugular and you can just enjoy him bringing the scene to those heights. The hair is just magical. I mean, it's like a comb-over, except he's not bald.
Right.
So as it's going over, it still has more hair to deal with. And the way he uses that in various scenes is its own running gag that I loved. The bit I think that does define him here, though, is one where he loses it after the experiment seems to have failed, then
with
composes
dignity.
Himself, yes, and says that he has to learn to accept his failures with quiet dignity and grace.
Uh-huh.
Nothing.
Oh, doctor, I'm sorry.
No. Be of good cheer. If science teaches us anything, it teaches us to accept our failures as well as our successes with quiet dignity and grace.
Son of a bitch bastard, I'll get you for this! What did you do to me? What did you do to me?
Doctor, stop it! You'll kill him!
I think that captures the Wilder ethos, that his characters were incapable of that. And we watched them spiral away from it. And it was giddily delightful to watch them. But the key is not just that he worked himself up into a comic frenzy.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's that all of his characters really wanted to have that dignity and grace. And it's in those quiet moments where you saw that that's really what they want. So he wasn't a funny guy.
Yeah.
Getting to the big blowout gag. He was someone who wanted to have dignity and grace.
Right.
And just was incapable.
Well, that's a great point. And that's actually what the whole film is kind of about, right? A guy who is constantly having to push down his inner monster, if you will. The fact that he really is, at his core, a Frankenstein.
Very first scene in the classroom where he's...
Think about how slowly he talks, how calm, how artificially calm he tries
it's
to make himself.
It's such an effort
for him. Yeah. The fact that they... cut to him, Mel Brooks cuts to the close-up when he does the first, it's Frankenstein. He's really composing himself. So that fits overall with the whole film. And you touched about when he does ratchet things up and that being one of those defining characteristics of Wilder, that comic frenzy. There is, without a doubt, always something thrilling about watching him then do the complete opposite of that real comportment, losing complete control. He stays in control in a way. He over-enunciates. He articulates really clearly, but he just steadily gets louder and louder and louder. And so that's what's so fun about that. But it's funny that you mention what he can do with a glance. Because for me, my favorite part of watching Gene Wilder, at least watching him here in Young Frankenstein, is watching him when he's in on the joke. So, and I don't mean a breaking the fourth wall moment. Wilder doesn't really do that here. Maybe once or twice. It's more Igor, Marty Feldman.
Right.
Who's brilliant here in this movie.
So good.
Who gives us some of those looks. But when he meets him at the train station in Transylvania, and of course the famous line that supposedly Aerosmith got the idea for the song Walk This Way from, was Igor saying Walk This Way, as he then, with his hunched back and everything and his cane, he kind of hobbles sideways down the stairs.
Cane.
Right. He hobbles down the stairs. And just because you've watched the first 20 minutes of this film and maybe you've seen one or two Mel Brooks movies, you know that Gene Wilder is then going to grab the cane and he's going to walk down the stairs exactly like Igor. even though he doesn't have to. He hunches over. It is funny. The joke could have stopped there, and it would have been pretty funny. But what happens instead is Wilder gets a few steps down, realizes what Igor meant, and we get that shot where he has that aha moment. Oh, that's not what he meant. And watching him in close-up have that aha moment adds another layer to the gag.
So let's talk about the supporting performances given by the women in this film, because I don't know if Brooks is given enough credit for really making a lot of room for female comedians and then giving them full-fledged characters to play and just take as wild as Gene Wilder takes his characters. You've got Madeline Kahn, mm-hmm. Terry Garr, Cloris Leachman.
They're all brilliant.
They're all
three of them.
Doing very different things as well and playing roles that maybe are to the side in the way that a horror picture of the era that they're spoofing might have been, but they make so much out of it.
They do. You really do reappreciate. I always liked her because of movies like Mr. Mom, and of course she's in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I looked over Terry Garr's filmography today. There weren't as many really memorable films on there as I would have liked to have seen, but she's always been memorable in her performances.
The performances. Yes.
Yes, and she is so wonderful here. And of course, you mentioned Madeline Kahn. That whole bit at the train station with him leaving and her saying not on the lips, mm-hmm. and then not the hair and not everything else is pure comedic brilliance.
What? I'm going to that party at Nana and Nikki's later. I don't want to smear my lipstick. Oh. You understand.
Of course.
All aboard!
Oh, dear.
Well, I guess this is it.
Freddie, darling. Well, how can I say in a few minutes what it's taken me a lifetime to understand?
Won't you try?
All right. You've got it, mister. I'm yours, all of me. What else can I say?
My sweet love.
The hair. Just been set.
Sorry.
When I listed this movie as one of my top five non-kids movies to show your kids, and yeah, I was kind of going out on a limb because I haven't seen this movie since I was in college is actually when I saw it. And no, that wasn't 1974, but I was with my college roommate. I think we were at his place in St. Louis and we had some friends over and we were into comedy. So we thought we should catch up with this Mel Brooks classic. And we laughed a lot throughout the movie. We got to that putting on the Ritz bit.
Oh,
and it's hard to explain even. I don't know. Maybe someone out there has tried. If you tried to articulate to someone why that scene is so funny, I can't do it anyway. All I know is there's something just instinctual about it. It provokes an instinctual, urgent reaction to laugh. And maybe it's a little bit that we know the song, too. So when Peter Boyle sings Putting on the Ritz, we know what he's supposed to be saying. And just the way he says it, that kind of monster, slurred voice, there is something inherently funny about that. Now, my kids did not laugh as much at that scene because they don't know what Putting on the Ritz is. Hmm. They don't know how the song's supposed to go. And they didn't have that instinctual, urgent reaction that we all did. You know what was absolutely hilarious to them? Like, always got a laugh every time it came up, and there's about seven times it comes up in the movie, and I laughed every time as well. Frau Blücher. Every time Cloris Leachman says that, and the horses neigh. Again, I can't explain to you why, but it's hilarious.
Well, because it's letting us in on the joke, and suddenly we're not just in the audience anymore, we're almost creating it with the filmmakers because it repeats. It's a callback. And this film uses callback jokes a couple of times. Think of the scene where Frankenstein and the inspector are playing darts and they're getting increasingly erratic where the darts are thrown. I actually missed this, but B pointed it out later.
Yeah,
when the inspector leaves.
All the darts are in the car.
Not only that, but his driver has one in his hat.
One in his hat, yeah.
So again, that's just, you know, bringing us along in on the gag. And as far as putting on the Ritz goes, I mean, yeah, it's a funny voice. It's absolutely ridiculous what they're doing. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of comic layers going on here. The fact that this scientist would use this as a way to demonstrate, like, this is his proof, right, that this creature can do putting on the Ritz, as if all the scientists in the crowd, if they are impressed and entertained, they will back his science.
Yes, that's enough.
So that's one thing. But really, it's also built in character, right? The creature, Peter Boyle gives this creature such a yearning that mm-hmm. you would never guess while also allowing him to be scary and threatening. I remember as a kid when I saw this being terrified of that scene with the little girl in the well. I thought for sure she was going down there.
I
still was a little scared
this
time.
Well, there is that great moment, right? What else can we throw down there? The camera cuts away.
And Boyle gives you – he looks in – he breaks the fourth wall there.
Yeah.
But going back to the putting on the Ritz scene, he also wants so badly to be loved. Mm-hmm. And he's trying so hard to pull off that performance. And it's also just enjoyable to see Wilder tap dancing as he is and putting on this a little bit of Wonka here, right? A little bit of the showman. So that's just maybe the highlight of the film for a whole host of reasons.
Yeah, for sure. A couple other bits that made the kids laugh, and I point these out mainly because they cracked me up as well. And you talk about recurring jokes. The whole Frankenstein thing really pays off, of course, early in the film, going back to that train station scene with Igor, where then he says, no, it's Frankenstein. He says, and you're Igor. And he says, no, now it's Igor.
That's as if he knows, right?
Right.
As if he's been playing along on the joke. Yeah.
Now it's Igor. And then he, of course, suggests that maybe he should be called Frodrick instead. Now, the kids also really love the moment when they get into the old study of his grandfather and there's the book on the table, How I Did It.
Yeah.
There is something cartoonishly funny about that moment. But then there are other more subtle moments, Josh. We've talked about a few of them in the film, but I actually thought it was hilarious how we get that conversation that happens on the train when Wilder first leaves for New York. And there's this American couple telling this old familiar kind of story about something in their family. And then later, when he's heading finally to Transylvania, he is sitting in front of a European couple, and they're saying the exact same thing, essentially, but, of course, in a different language. There's just that sense of Brooks understanding what sort of connects us all as people, and just those little insights like that, I think, really elevate this movie beyond just being another sort of gag movie. And I think the way that we also see that, Josh, is that this is a film very much, of course, you could say paying homage to these classic horror movies, and obviously in some way parodying them as well. But what he does and what the key to any good parody is accuracy. And I read about how the lab equipment, apparently, you see it in the credits.
Yeah,
actually,
they do mention
the film,
it.
Kenneth Strickfaden, he did the original set design and stuff, all the props for the 1931 Frankenstein, so they got him to do it here. It does feel like that, of course. All those shots we've ever seen, whether we've seen that movie or just seen clips of it, we are familiar with every bit of the modern technology that is in that basement. But, of course, it's the other things. It's the black and white. It's the opening credits. I loved watching the opening credits, actually just looking at the house up on
that
the hill.
The slow pan into the castle.
And the score. John Morris, his score here is just note perfect. All those touches that really make it feel like one of those movies, but it's not indebted to them in the way where you can only appreciate this film if you get all of those references. It exists fully in its own universe, in this universe that Brooks and Wilder have created.
And I think maybe that's something that's missing or certainly lessened in Brooks's later work, something like Spaceballs, which obviously has his funny moments of parody, but it does not recreate the Star Wars universe. And you might say, well, who could recreate the Star Wars universe? But look at Young Frankenstein, the cinematographer I don't think we've mentioned yet, Gerald Hirschfeld. And this could stand up against James Whale's 1931 Frankenstein.
There's a real elegance to the camera
design,
work,
lighting, all of that stuff. I remember when I saw this as a kid, one of the things that drew me to it was that I knew the 1931 film and appreciated that atmospheric horror that it had and thought, wow, this looks something like that, but it's new and it's funny and I'm going to check this out. And sure enough, it delivers on that count. So you're absolutely right that it's one of those levels beyond the broad gags that we get a lot of and are maybe the surface attraction to this film, but the production design, all these other elements add so much more.
One closing shot. Set a give, that whole bit.
And that comes
with
back
the charades.
Too, right? They use it again, which is just brilliant.
It is. For some reason, Young Frankenstein, it seems, is not available to rent via streaming. Someone probably should do something about that, but it is available to rent via Netflix. It's probably at your video store if one still exists near you, and at your local library if one exists near you. You might also check with your Uncle Larry, I'm pretty sure. He's got a VHS copy somewhere.
I was really disappointed my dad didn't have it on DVD.
No?
I thought for sure he'd be able to bail me out on this one.
If you see it, or if you've seen it and remember it fondly and agree or disagree with what we had to say, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
Up next, we're going to play a little Massacre Theater. Then Michael Phillips calls in from the Venice Film Festival to share his thoughts on the movies he's been seeing, the BBC list he voted in, and presumably gelato. Stay with us.
Ladies and gentlemen, mesdames et messieurs, damen und herren, from what was once an inarticulate mass of lifeless tissues, may I now present a cultured, sophisticated man about town. Hit it!
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits? Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes, or cutaway coat, perfect fits.
In the Reef!
Dressed up like a million-dollar trooper, trying mighty hard to look like Gary Cooper.
Ooper, ooper!
Come, let's mix where Rockefellers walk with sticks or Rumbarellers in their midst.
I just want to say for all the guys in Vietnam that we're doing our best. It's not an easy situation. But the boys' morale over there is real high. And you can feel confident that we are going to win that war.
Tom Cruise as Ron Kovic in that scene from 1989's Born on the 4th of July, directed, of course, by Oliver Stone. I didn't know this, Josh, but Oscar nominated for that performance. Tom Cruise, at the time, was the youngest ever nominated in the lead actor category.
That is surprising.
Yeah. Maybe because he doesn't seem quite that young in the movie, and just because you imagine over the years someone else would have slid into that spot. But indeed, a breakout performance for Cruise, I think, maybe not as a movie star, already pretty well established at that point, but as a quote-unquote serious actor. And of course, Oliver Stone had been making some serious films at that point. 1986, Platoon, Wall Street in 87, Talk Radio in 88, and then 89, Born on the 4th.
I can remember in 86, even as a 12-year-old at the time, knowing Platoon was important, wanting to see it, but it was sort of hard for me to get to Platoon as
was
a 12-year-old.
It?
Yeah, I didn't see it till years later.
So I saw it in the theater. I was 11.
Wow.
I remember my best friend, Matt, his mom took us to see the movie.
Really?
We went with her. I don't think there was any grand agenda. I just think it was a night out.
Lucky
and she
you.
Took us. Maybe we had an interest in the film. I'll have to ask Matt sometime if he remembers why we were so eager to see Platoon. Stone is back this fall with Snowden, his first high-profile pick in a while. It opens next weekend. Like Born on the 4th of July's Kovic, an Army veteran who became an anti-war protester, Snowden is about another pretty controversial political figure. I'm sure most people listening, if not all people listening, have a sense of who Snowden is. And if you don't, you could check out Laura Poitras's 2014 documentary, Citizen Four. That's one of the things I'm most curious about, is really to see what we get from the narrative version of the Snowden story versus what Poitras gave us in documentary form. Next week, we have a lot of scheduling things to work out, but we did tease this on our last episode. Whether we see Snowden or not, we will definitely talk a lot of Oliver Stone. We'll do a Sacred Cow review, another one, 2 weeks in a row of Born on the 4th of July, and we'll bring in the great film and TV critic and great lover of that movie, Matt Zoller-Seitz, to talk about his new book, The Oliver Stone Experience, that comes out next week. We'll talk about that book, and he's going to share his top five Oliver Stone scenes or moments. We've got a lot of prep to do, but it should be a good one.
Oh boy, do we. And I'm only a few chapters into Matt's book, and already I'm starting to feel that I greatly underappreciate Oliver Stone. So I think that's what projects like this are good for, forcing us to reassess, those of us who need it.
Yeah. And for me, I've already done just a little bit of homework. Some of his movies that I thought it would make sense for me to watch before we did this top five and before we really dove into the work of Stone. I saw Nixon, finally, and I saw Talk Radio. I can't say I loved either movie, but I'm definitely glad I saw them, especially Nixon, and the one big one left for me, and it is a big one. It's 3 hours long, but Matt Zoller Seitz does recommend seeing Heaven and Earth. So that's one of those from Stone's filmography I may need to check off. If you've got some catching up to do, you've got a little bit of time to prepare. I guess you can always, for the podcast listeners, Josh, they can just decide to revisit this episode in 6 months when they've done
all their homework. After they've watched every Oliver Stone film.
There you go.
Why
not? Don't have that luxury. We did want to mention, speaking of luxuries, that we're giving away some free tickets. Been doing this a lot here on the show here recently. And if you go to filmspotting.net right now, you can enter to win passes to see advanced screenings of The New Blair Witch, The J.T. LeRoy Story, and Operation Avalanche. So go to filmspotting.net for more information about those films. On our last episode, episode 601, we reviewed very favorably and actually made it a Golden Brick contender, the final movie in our contemporary Nordic cinema marathon. So contemporary, it's considered a 2016 film, Rams from Iceland.
Yeah, and was that Håkan Norsen's first film or second?
I'm not going to hazard a response because I don't know the answer.
For some reason, I want to say second, but certainly he qualifies.
Yeah, he definitely qualifies for our Golden Brick criteria as far as overlooked films that show a real vision and that we want to share with more people. We are going to put off our Nordic Cinema Awards for a little while, and we're still looking for a great name if you have any ideas for those awards.
It's going to be hard to beat Sad Tubas, though.
I agree, but that came in-house, and I love it when the listeners suggest one. So you still got a little bit of time for that. We'll do that on episode 604 in a couple of weeks. And I mentioned the Golden Bricks. This was an idea Sam, our wonderful producer, had, and I thought it was worth doing because we've got a lot of time before we're even going to really unveil all the contenders for the Golden Brick and then later share the top five finalists. That's probably what we'll do just like we did last year. Of course, we'll name the winner of the Golden Brick in January at the wrap party we are currently planning. But in November is when we kind of usually lay those out on a show and we revisit some of our past reviews. But right now we do have 9 different films that all qualify for the Golden Brick. And if you need more homework to do for listening to Film Spotting, if you go to our Golden Bricks page at our website, it's right there under the top 5 navigation. You can see those 9 titles and you can also see how you can view them. All but 2 of them you can watch at home right now. 2 are still in theatrical release. I recommended Southside with You last week on the show. That qualifies. And I'm drawing a blank, Josh, on the other one. Maybe The Fitz, actually, a film we reviewed here on the show. No, that's actually available too.
Yeah, I think that's out streaming.
There's one way to see that. But one other film you can't see. Otherwise, 7 of them you can see right from the comfort of your own home. So again, go to filmspotting.net and look for the Golden Bricks page if you are curious about those. Also at filmspotting.net, that's where you can vote in our biweekly poll questions. And we actually added one here under the radar. We wanted to get everyone's take on Gene Wilder with his passing. Thanks to everyone who voted in that. Josh, of course, you shared those results a little earlier, but there's still voting going on. We'll share the results next week in our Better Robot performance. Alicia Vikander or Michael Fassbender both star in The Light Between Oceans, which just opened last weekend. Still unseen by both of us. It opened to pretty lackluster business, though I can't say we were probably expecting that it would rake in the money at the box office. Obviously, they should have made the movie about a couple of robots who raise an abandoned baby.
Yes.
I mean, that sci-fi element and dollar signs indeed. Missed opportunity there. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. With that, let's get to Massacre Theater.
It is the part of the show where we perform a scene and you get a chance at winning a prize. A couple weeks back, Adam and I, along with a little primitive voice processing work by Sam, massacred this scene.
Hold it right there.
Yes.
You mean yes?
Yes.
Is that all you can say?
No.
No, anything else?
Yes.
Positive and negative, huh? You're a bit.
Yes.
Well, where's your program? Isn't he gonna miss you?
No.
I'm your program.
Yes.
Another mouth to feed.
Yes, 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 yes.
That was Jeff Bridges with Just Some Zeros and Ones, Man, in 1982's Tron, written and directed by Steve Leisberger.
Yeah.
Lisberger? So, Lisberger?
Let's go Lisberger.
I don't remember.
No, okay. I don't either. You, of course, doing your stoner Lebowski Jeff Bridges impression, you did not nail that zeros and ones line the way you did your a bit. That was your home run moment.
That was the one syllable
that was
I got
the one,
right.
The one syllable that really, really sounded
sometimes
just like
that's
Jeff
all
Bridges.
You need.
Yeah. That Massacre was part of our fall movie preview back on episode 599. For the connection to Tron, here's longtime listener Rose Messer from Naperville.
This could only be Tron, with the connection being Jeff Bridges, who is in both Tron and Hell or High Water, which was also reviewed on that episode. I couldn't stop laughing at the Adam performance. You guys should do a whole show with these voices and vocal effects. Maybe that could be the defining moment we talk about on episode 700. As always, thanks for an entertaining show.
Okay, so we speculated off air that Sam might add that vocal effect. And after the performance, I was so proud of myself for doing my version of a funny voice that I thought he's not going to need to do
it.
It's going to be hilarious without it. And then I listened to the show like everyone else. And
you were cut.
Instead of laughing, I was horrified that my vocal work was just cast aside. Actually, I was laughing hilariously. And I think that without it, it wouldn't have been nearly as funny. So Sam, as always, wins. You were right again.
Yes, 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 yes.
Tony Morfitt in North Liberty, Iowa writes, "How dare Adam compare barbed wire to Tron? Having been a hormonal teenager in the mid-90s, I saw barbed wire, but didn't remember a second of it. Tron, on the other hand, was a seminal movie for us video game nerds. Bruce Boxleitner has never been better. Maybe Adam saw this because of the very forgettable, much too late sequel that came out a while back. Bruce Boxleitner was wasted in that one. I still don't know why I watched Tron like 5 years ago."
I'm going to guess that's more Bruce Boxleitner talk that has ever taken place
in
on
the
this
history
show.
Of the show. Yeah, and it definitely wasn't for the Tron remake or whatever you want to call it that came out there that Tony alludes to, not seen by me or reviewed here on the show.
Trace in Bloomington, Illinois shared this note. "The only tie-in I noticed was with Jeff Bridges from Hell or High Water, but please know that this may have been the fastest I've ever known the scene from a Massacre Theater, probably in half of the first line. Fun facts about me and Tron." Let's share, Trace. "This is one of 13 movies my family owned on Betamax. We were that one family that had Betamax."
For us, it was Chad Meacham. The Meachums had the beta.
"I taught myself to read from the 33 and a third speed vinyl record and read along book. I beat the light cycle level of the arcade game on my first quarter. I played brutal games of Tron with my friends that mostly involved whipping frisbees at each other's heads and occasionally blocking until one friend had to get stitches." We played that too. No stitches, though. We survived. "Thanks for using one of the most memorable scenes from a childhood favorite," Trey says. "I'm sure many other entries from those born in the 70s are competing with this one."
Finally, Daniel Smith in Omaha, Nebraska says, "Even though this movie is dated, it is one of my guilty pleasures. I am a programmer, and it is fun to see how many technical terms they can get into the movie, even if they are not used in the correct context." So that was the funniest part for me. As I was preparing for my performance, reading the scene and watching the scene, it really is filled with just the most obvious computer jargon
nonsense
of the time. Yeah, it really doesn't make any sense. Daniel there confirms that, but they did try to jam it all in. Now, one final note about that performance, or actually the aftermath of it. You made a comment, Josh, when I said that I finally just recently caught up with this movie like a few years ago, and you said that I was about 25 years too late.
Yeah.
A couple listeners took issue with that.
Let me guess. The math was not exact.
They said the math was not right.
I knew the math wasn't right when I said it. But you know the difference is?
What?
I don't care.
You don't care. But no, see, I wish now I hadn't brought it up,
Josh. Was I in the ballpark?
Well, kind of. It's like 30-some years ago. I actually
So we're talking about a difference of 6 years?
No,
five
we're
years?
Talking about, we will look it up again. The original Tron here was 1982. So 34 years ago, off by less than a decade. But I actually thought you were being quite astute, Josh. I thought you were pointing out, this is what I told our listeners, and it turns out now I was lying in my defense of you. I thought you were being really right on, because if you go back 25 years, I actually would have been right in the wheelhouse of when people would have loved the movie Tron. I would have been a teenager.
Okay.
So that's what I was going with.
Well, thanks for trying to defend me.
I tried.
But, you know,
I'm never going to do it again.
I'm not too worried about it.
All right. Well, why don't you reach into the film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner?
The winner is Rob Bond from down the road a little bit here in Bourbonnais, Illinois.
Congratulations, Rob. Email feedback@filmspotting.net and we will set you up with your very own film spotting t-shirt.
That was the greatest acting I have ever seen.
I just don't know how you do it, Gary. How do you make yourself so somber and emotional to make everybody cry like that?
It's not that hard, really. I just think about the saddest moment in my life.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater. We'll tell you, even though I don't know why we're telling you this, because it's going to be so insanely easy and obvious to anyone who has seen this film.
This should be an easy one.
Yeah, that it does tie in with our top five comedies of the 21st century. It's so easy, pun fully intended here. We are going to serve this one to you on a platter.
You know, you were a bit of a diva. I'm going to share this. You just added more lines for yourself before we started here.
You're right.
Sam had it ready
You're
to
right.
go.
Yeah.
What was the actual
I had one
phrase?
Line.
I have one line.
And I'm going to make up for it another way, too. I've got another plan to compensate here.
I can't wait.
I'm going to try to keep you on your toes here. It's the way I like to do
Massacre
my
Theater
acting.
Improv, huh?
That's right. Okay, so.
Let's go.
You know, I'm not just going to let you wax rhapsodically here and go off on your little soliloquy without a little action for myself. So
I can't wait.
I started off, and then that's all I do. Are you ready?
Let's go. And
you give me the action.
Action.
What are you, prospecting? Jesus Christ, you are a dangerous man. You're going to risk our lives for a Twinkie?
There's a box of Twinkies in that grocery store. Not just any box of Twinkies. The last box of Twinkies that anyone will enjoy in the whole universe. Believe it or not, Twinkies have an expiration date. Someday, very soon, life's little Twinkie gauge is gonna go empty. Time to nut up or shut up.
And scene. Thank sound
you.
Effects.
Thank you for the sound
effects. I'm trying to provide mood there,
we'll
Josh.
We'll see if Sam
atmosphere.
Can do something to that, too.
Oh, yeah. We definitely
a
need
bit.
A little audio help with that one.
If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title, along with your name and location, to feedback@filmspotting.net. The deadline is Monday, September 19th. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced in a couple of weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Yes? May I help you?
Someone is in trouble. Who are you? What are you doing in Ruth's apartment?
She's letting me stay here. I'm her niece. My name's Betty.
No, it's not. That's not what she said. Someone is in trouble. Something bad is happening.
A clip there from the best film of the 21st century, at least according to the 177 critics who submitted a ballot to the BBC earlier this year. They probably wouldn't get much argument from me. Naomi Watts with Lee Grant and that scene from David Lynch's Mulholland Drive. Among those 177 ballots is one that had, inexplicably, wild hogs in 5 of the 10 slots. Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune on the line from Venice, Italy. Michael, care to explain yourself? Wild hogs were shocked.
Wild hogs. I'm a man of the open road. You know, I didn't find wild hogs funny. I found it shattering and beautiful as a portrait of middle-aged angst and, you know, pathetic men finding themselves in the company of I actually hated more The Hangover, and that was a huge hit. So what can I do?
Okay.
Nothing.
Well, we will get to some comedies you did love, and we will get to the BBC list and your actual top 10 ballot here in a little bit. But we have to start with where you're calling from. Venice, Italy. Your first trip to the Venice Film Festival, I believe. How's it going so far?
Yes, it's great. You know, it is a very, very pleasurable festival. Now, I'm here. I should explain. I'm not here covering the Venice Film Festival in the ordinary kind of work mode. I'm on a panel called the Biennale College, which is a subgroup of four projects, kind of like the Sundance Lab, where the festival itself supports the development of four low-budget projects from different corners of the world. And in this case, they fund them all the way to completion, and then they present the films. And then a few of us from the States, including Kenny Turan from the LA Times, Stephanie Zaharik from Time Magazine, Glenn Kenny from the New York Times, a lot of people are coming over on the panel. And we all, you know, just sort of enjoyed this more relaxed schedule. We're not really covering the festival because it would be kind of a conflict of interest to be in Ollie's paying for our way over and all that. So unusual situation for me, but as much as I can judge it like a normal critic, though, this is the most pleasurable and enjoyable festival I've ever been to outside Telluride in Colorado. And I'm still trying to figure out why, but it is, guys, and I feel privileged and fortunate just to be able to say this, it is the opposite of a can. It's like there's no compression, there's no crush of people, there's not even that many American journalists over here, but and yet Venice is this immense, you know, it's one of the big five or six international festivals. And I don't know if you realize this, but the gelato is fantastic over here.
So I've heard. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're getting to enjoy that. How about, you've seen some movies though, right? What have you been able to catch and what's really stood out so far?
The film that opened the Venice Festival, Josh, was Damien Chazelle's musical La La Land, which I've been looking forward to anyway because I was a big fan of his previous films, Whiplash, and the micro-budget musical he made when he was still in school, Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench. And La La Land really killed over here, and then it went directly to Telluride, which is essentially concurrent with the timing of Venice. So, you know, a lot of big films for the fall season open almost simultaneously in Venice and Italia. Anyway, that was the case with La La Land. And it's not perfect, but it's wonderful in many ways. This is the Ryan Gosling, Emma Stone musical. It's a full-on widescreen musical with actual singing and dancing and breaking into song. It's not one of these apologetic movie musicals. And it opens with a number that is, I almost defy anybody to not enjoy it. A really festive opening to a festival. And since I'm kind of a whore for musicals, I'm just fascinated at the attempt of making the film that Chazelle made. Anyway, good start. I suggest you guys see it. You're going to see it anyway.
Yeah,
you're
we're going
see
to.
It anyway.
We can't wait. One of our most anticipated, certainly of this year and of this fall, for sure. So that is a movie that you probably hadn't high expectations for the reasons you said, and it sounds like it didn't really disappoint. Was there anything you saw that did disappoint, or conversely, that maybe you had no expectations for and surprised you?
Well, the Mel Gibson film, Hacksaw Ridge, his first film as director in 10 years. This is the film about it's a true story about the Seventh-day Adventist Desmond T. Doss, who was the first conscientious objector in World War II to receive the Congressional Medal of Honor, and he was a medic who fought at the Battle of Okinawa, and he saved essentially 75 lives. It's a really, really riveting true story that Mel Gibson has made into a Mel Gibson movie, and we'll talk more at length, hopefully later on when it opens in November, about what that actually means. I guess I was surprised, guys, at what a strong critical reception this film got, because I was much more mixed and kind of resistant to it. It's the most bloodthirsty movie I've ever seen about pacifism. I'll tell you that much. And
for Mel Gibson,
I know it's right in line with. It is the bloodiest movie about a pacifist since The Passion of the Christ. But it's it's got. I guess I don't care how I fit in with the general mainstream of opinion. And because I wasn't filing on deadline like I often do on a festival sort of news cycle. I was just sort of watching it happen because I saw a later screening here, and just to see how, in general, the film really clobbered audiences in a way that they respected. It was not my experience of it, so it's not a dismissible effort, and it's such an amazing true story, at least a kernel of a true story. And Andrew Garfield is quite good, and the acting is. Look, I always say this: the acting is never the problem with movies. It's just the reception of it surprised me, but I think I'll tell you, it's going to be a huge hit, and it's got an enormous built-in double audience between all the faith-based audiences that are waiting for an actual big movie, and all the World War II buffs and war movie buffs who are just hungry for another true story of that conflict, and it's the story of this guy Desmond T. Doss. This corporal, whose name is not well known, but is, you know, that's an interesting fact that if you're the first conscientious objector to get the Congressional Medal of Honor, what is your story? That's a good start. I don't know. For me, though, I'm still wrestling with it. So, you know, that was a case where I just felt like, I need to see it again before it opens in November to really deal with it properly. So, yeah.
What about the latest from Tom Ford, Jake Gyllenhaal, Nocturnal Animals, another one that there's been a fair amount of buzz about?
Yeah, that was a highlight for me. Nocturnal Animals. It's based on a novel called Tony and Susan, which I haven't read, but it's about this L.A. art dealer played by Amy Adams, who one day gets a manuscript in the mail from her ex-husband, Jake Gyllenhaal, and it's a novel dedicated to her, and it turns out to be this brutal story, this novel this fellow's written about abduction, rape, and murder in West Texas, and this is the story that we also see dramatized in the movie, sort of imagined as she's reading it. It's a film within a film. And in that film within a film, Michael Shannon plays the sheriff on the case in this West Texas, you know, this miserable West Texas dramatic criminal case. And I'll tell you, guys, Michael Shannon makes a movie every 6 weeks, and he is wearing very well as Screen Company. This is one of my favorite performances of his, and that's reason enough for me to recommend it. So, but Tom, I like Tom Ford a lot. It's a, you know, you remember A Single Man with Colin Firth, and
great film.
You know, that interesting, very deliberate and slightly unrealistic visual style, and he's carried that over here. So it's not for everybody, and I'm glad of it personally. But that was a real highlight for me, Nocturnal Animals, as opposed to the new Terrence Malick film.
Uh-oh.
Really?
Yeah. Can I leave my line reading up high like that, just sort of dangling?
You can't,
except you guys wonder.
He has so many in post-production or slated to come out. I don't know which one you're talking about.
Right. Well, this is Voyage of Time, Life's Journey. This is kind of an expansion of that Birth of the Cosmos section of The Tree of Life, which was hugely controversial. This is the people refer to as the dinosaur part, Tree of Life. But, you know, I'm eager to revisit that film, guys, Tree of Life, that is, now that I've seen this, just to see why I thought that that mixture of sort of one story with a sudden sort of IMAX intrusion of this Birth of the Cosmos segment, why that worked for me and why this entire film, which is, you know, purely dedicated to kind of an imagistic, you know, Earth Mother exploration of how we got here and how the cosmos came to be, covers 14 billion years, why the whole thing felt like it lasted 14 billion years. I don't know. It's elegant, but kind of a stiff. And Cate Blanchett murmuring this narration, you know, about Mother, can you hear me? And it's all rhetorical questions unanswered, which I know faith and spirituality requires that sort of leap of faith, but it's not for me. And there's also a 45-minute version coming out that has a voiceover narration by Brad Pitt, who's one of the producers. So maybe it'll fly better in the IMAX 45-minute version than the 90-minute version I saw. But to me, I just worry that we've lost Terrence Malick as a filmmaker now, the last two or three films, and I don't know if we're ever going to get him back.
Yeah, I would concur with that. As much as I do love The Tree of Life, I can't say you've made me any more excited about Voyage of Time. Going back to Tom Ford real quick, you had me already buying a ticket at Film Within a Film. Now you have me standing in line in advance with Michael Shannon. So you've sold me on that one, Michael.
Good.
So, Michael, one of the other reasons we want to have you on, and thanks for staying up late to do this, by the way, is to get your thoughts on Gene Wilder. With his passing, we've been reconsidering his work and his performances and had a chance to talk about Young Frankenstein in a Sacred Cow review. Was there one thing you would say was his defining quality as an actor, whether that's specifically a comic actor or just an actor in general, when you look back at his big roles?
When I wrote An Appreciation after Wilder died, you know, like a lot of people, I wrote quickly, and you know, you sort of realize that you're doing an inadequate job of assessing it, you know, an actor's whole career, but you know, I did it anyway, and I kind of focused on the one, maybe the obvious point about how amazingly good and very, very funny he was at the sort of slowly building and tightly coiled mania, you know, this where you just sort of sense this rising exasperation where he's just basically going to lose it. And he is so damn funny in Young Frankenstein. It's my favorite performance in his Young Frankenstein, because he gets so many different kinds of funny, not just in the film, but within that one performance. But then I got some interesting and really thoughtful email from several people who, you know, really loved Wilder for all kinds of reasons. And a couple of them said the same thing. They said, you know, the Wilder is sort of the, with the short fuse and the mania and the really kind of carefully calibrated explosions of rage is one half of what he was great at. But he's got such a kind of a gentle, melancholy, bittersweet quality and a delicate touch. And that you have to remember that. And I think that's true.
Evidence in Wonka, I think, especially. You see a lot of that in his Willy Wonka performance.
Absolutely. And yeah, especially when he sings, you know, he's not a natural musical comedy performer, but he knows how to do it. And he knows how to make some sense out of that twisted character that Roald Dahl created. I don't know. I guess I didn't realize how much it would, you know, a lot of people say, well, I didn't realize how much somebody meant to me until they're gone. But Wilder's work in several films, but particularly Young Frankenstein, I just think that you can go back and try to find obvious inspirations or, you know, precedents for someone's kind of comic touch or the sort of the charisma he brought to something, or eccentric comic charm or whatever you want to apply to it. But I don't find too many with Wilder. He was truly unique. And I'll tell you, his first film right out of the gate, Bonnie and Clyde, 1967, he's only got a couple of scenes, but you know instantly that he is completely up to the skill set of everybody else on screen. He's uniquely funny as that Undertaker. And, you know, he is absolutely ready to go. And by the time the producers came along a year later, from my perspective, he is the freshest single element today in Mel Brooks' movie, The Producers. I think there's a lot of funny things in it. I think it was a nervy kind of landmark for the time. I think a lot of it is really poorly and over and badly directed. I think Zero Mostel needed about 6 more inches away from the camera to be completely effective, because I feel like that performance is right down my neck every second. Gene Wilder, genius every second. I mean, I think everything he tries is still funny.
Mm-hmm. Certainly some Pantheon-level comedic performances from Gene Wilder, and that helps us transition to another Pantheon of sorts. As we alluded to off the top of this segment here with you, Michael, the BBC recently published a list of the top 100 films of the 21st century, so 2000 up to the present day, essentially. 177 critics submitted ballots. Sadly, Josh and me left off. We didn't get to play in the reindeer game. So, but it just would have been more votes for Mulholland Drive for me, and that would have been boring, Michael. So maybe it was a good thing. Looking at the list, and it's a list after my own heart, there's 100 slots, but 103 movies on it because of how the points kind of all came out. And for what it's worth out there, I don't know if listeners already did this, but I did check to see how many of the 103 I've seen. I felt pretty good with how I did, 85 of them. So I still have a little bit of homework to do, but I've seen 85. The biggest blind spot for me, and I've known about this, I've known it's a blind spot going back before film spotting started, but certainly when it started, this was a film former co-host, now producer Sam Van Hallgren, always extolled the virtues of. Yi Yi, the Edward Yang film, is the highest ranked movie I've not seen, number 8 on the BBC list. So that's something we need to remedy soon here, Josh.
Yi, also one of the 19 on the list I have not seen. So okay. Yeah, need to get to that.
So real quick, Michael, before we get to your picks, I do want to share the top 10 as they shook out from the BBC, as they sort of aggregated all of the votes. Number 10, No Country for Old Men. Number 9, A Separation. 8, Yi Yi. Number 7, Terrence Malick, The Tree of Life. Number 6, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Number 5, Boyhood. Number 4, Spirited Away. Number 3, There Will Be Blood. Number 2, In the Mood for Love, Wong Kar-wai. And number 1, of course, Mulholland Drive. I can't say there were any picks there that really surprised me. The closest surprise for me would be actually the Farhadi film, A Separation. I know it was highly acclaimed. It made my top 10 of that year as well, but I wouldn't have necessarily picked it as a no-brainer for the top 10 on this list. Michael, how did you feel overall when you saw the list after you blindly submitted your picks? How did you feel about how it came out?
I felt like it's been a better 17 years than I realized. Maybe it's just that we're coming off summer, which is a season that can test, you know, even the optimistic moviegoer. It's a great reminder, I think, just that, and you tend to gravitate toward the directors that mean something to you, whose visions, whose literal visual authority really, really matters and really kind of guides whatever story is being told in a way that just wouldn't have been done the same way by somebody else. It's a great reminder. I think I share your feeling about A Separation, a film I admire tremendously, but it's certainly not a visually aggressive movie. It's a very tight, precise, meticulous visual sort of aesthetic going on there. But I guess in large part, I was responding personally when I picked my 10 in a typically haphazard, half-assed way, I think, because there's 15 right behind it that I would have been pretty happy with swapping in. But I think a lot of people felt that frustration doing this. You know how this is. But
sure.
I just went for visions that sort of jumped out at me a little more. But you know, I'm not sure I'd vote the same way tomorrow.
Well, why don't we share the list that you did
submit. And starting at the top here with number 10, you had Zodiac, The Grand Budapest Hotel, Poetry, Boyhood, Her, Y Tu Mama Tambien, Mulholland Drive, Climates, the Nuri Bilge Ceylan film that you've talked about many times in the show with us. And then at the top, Ratatouille, and your number one choice was There Will Be Blood.
Yeah, I tried not to pick There Will Be Blood, but I picked it anyway. I did. I just
couldn't get around it.
I knew it's got that kind of received modern classic aura, and I just suspected it would end up on a lot of, you know, top 10 out of 100 lists. And I don't necessarily want to jump in and join the crowd on that. But I had just seen it again on a nice 35 millimeter print over at the Music Box. And, you know, even with the problems more in the last third, which I'll never resolve in my head with that film, I still think it's the American, for whatever it's worth, it's the whatever the distinction's worth, it's the American film of the early 21st century for me. I think that says the most about who we are, and, you know, and it says it more, less about the narrative and more just in terms of this really complicated and troubling tone. And it's often blackly funny, you know. I actually picked a weird amount of comedy out of a list that is largely not devoted to comedy.
Yeah, and that's what we're using the list for, to jump off into our top five for this week, 21st century comedies, because that was one complaint against the list, is that there are no broad comedies, no pure comedies, I guess you would say. And certainly some, The Grand Budapest Hotel, for instance, have a lot of humor in them. Ratatouille, obviously, that you have on your list. But do you have any theories as to why nothing that could purely be seen as a comedy ended up making it on the final BBC list?
I mean, I actually don't consider The Grand Budapest Hotel or Ratatouille anything other than comedy. I that's what they are. I mean, they're maybe rueful or bittersweet comedies, but I guess if your distinction is broad comedy or kind of lower, or you know that sort of thing. Yeah, I mean, Borat certainly was a film that came up when you talk to a lot of different people about what's the funniest, what's the most kind of the nerviest broad comedy made in the last 17 years and in this century. Borat, the Sacha Baron Cohen film, I think would be my pick. And I guess also when I think back to 2006, 10 years ago, I just on some chemical level needed a movie that slapped this country around a little bit about some of its affairs of misbegotten foreign policy overseas. And I thought Cohen found a way through that character he'd already established in the British TV show, but he just found a way to, I think, really feel, make the mockumentary format feel like it hadn't been done a million times before. And actually, a lot of the best comedies, I think, you tell me what you guys think, a lot of the best comedies of the last 15, 17 years were coming out of this mockumentary form. You think about The Trip with Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon, Borat, as I mentioned, I think What We Do in the Shadows, the mockumentary about the vampires living in New Zealand, this is the one with Jermaine Clement, and I mean, I think that's hilarious.
It is, yeah.
Best in Show. A
couple of Christopher Guest films, yeah.
Exactly, Best in Show, and I mean, these are all kind of in that, there's something about that straight-faced, deadpan style that, of course, we know, too, from the mockumentary of look and feel of TV shows like, you know, The Office and Parks and Rec. It's fruitful. It still works somehow. But, you know, and the movies that were huge successes in the comic realm, especially more recent, like The Hangover, which I always beat up on, you know, what good did a conventional slickness do that film? Nothing. But again, you're looking at films like, you know, everything from Trainwreck to Bridesmaids to The 40-Year-Old Virgin. These are comedies that actually didn't just do the job for that season and make the money back. They're really revisitable. So, mm-hmm. You know, and I always point to the Lego Movie for a script that I thought was genuinely funny, and talk about unexpected. I mean, I went expecting almost nothing except to kind of resent how much money I've spent on Legos my whole life. But on the other hand, it's such a high quality product. Don't you think? Have you ever broken a piece of Lego? Has anybody
they
ever
do,
broken?
They do tend to last. That's a good point.
I've broken my ankle stepping on one.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it hasn't been that unfunny a stretch, but I think, would I put any of those up there? I don't know. There's something about comedy that the craft that goes into any kind of good comedy, even one that lasts a little while, tends not to be the same sort of achievement in most people's minds than other forms. And I guess that's just part of this bone-deep, ingrained prejudice against what is funny, mm-hmm. as yeah. opposed to what is, quote, serious.
Well, yeah. I think it is also a formal issue. I think you're hitting on it there, is that the movies that critics tend to want to dig into are formally interesting in terms of the editing, the cinematography, the mise-en-scene, whatever it might be, and comedies aren't associated with that. I don't know if it's a case of that they truly aren't, or that we don't do the work of unpacking their language and understanding how they too are using film form to be funny, or we just say, oh, well, it's comedy, so it's the material. It's not the filmmaking that's adding to it. And I think maybe if a little more time was put into studying that aspect of it, maybe we would have gotten a handful of these on the list, something like the Lego Movie and the way it uses, you know, its animation to sell the jokes, the visual gags. So
right,
I think form has a lot to do with it, with this bias, if you want to call it that, against comedies.
Hmm. Yeah, totally. And I think, but you look at a film like Borat, and it's instructive to remember that film is directed with a weirdly light touch. They know exactly how to get in and out and on and off a really rude, outlandish joke so deftly. I mean, that film only takes about 80 minutes minus the end credits, and it's got 6 credited writers. And they all earn their money. I mean, that film is, at least with an audience, at least 10 years ago, astonishingly funny. And, you know, I was actually kind of heartened. And I haven't seen this new film from Germany that people just adore coming out of Cannes that I'll see next week up at Toronto. But it's Tony Erdmann.
Yeah, made the list, the BBC list.
It's the 100. It's the number 100. And, you know, I did sort of smile just thinking, hey, great, a 3-hour German comedy is one of the 100 greatest you know, yeah. films of the so I do have you know, who knows, and I haven't read enough about that film to know what sort of funny or what's the real achievement going on mm-hmm. in some people's minds. But I'm just eager to see it.
Yeah, we are as well, Michael. We are going to get to our top 5 comedies of the 21st century here in a little bit. We'll see how many of our picks you spoiled with all of your great choices there in your discussion. Thank you so much for staying up so late with us there in Venice to chat with us. It was a lot of fun, illuminating as always. I'd feel sorry for you it being so late, except for the fact that you have all that gelato and all those gondolas, and it's just so beautiful and scenic. I don't really feel sorry for you at all, actually.
It's it's great. Although, you know, I will say, I hate to be serious for a moment, but it's a real drag to be away this long when you actually miss your family intensely, yeah. which is it's no fun kind of readjusting your life to this sort of, it's like you feel like you're single again for a week or 10 days or 2 weeks covering these festivals, but it's not necessarily a life I want to do any more than I have to. So anyway, that's a nice feeling. It's 2 notes at once, if you know what I mean. I love the gelato. I love the idea of going home.
Michael, we miss you too.
That's all right. Very, very thoughtful of you.
I know. I'm speaking in code. I'm speaking of you guys, not uh-huh. Heidi Steve.
We know. We know. Heidi, we can throw her in as well. Michael, thank you. We will look forward to getting you back here stateside and here in the studio soon.
Thanks,
all right,
Michael.
Guys, take care.
We're going to soldier on here in unexotic Chicago. The film Spotting Top 5, our favorite comedies of the 21st century, is next.
In fact, let's get it started with this voicemail from Andy in Philly, his choice for the number one comedy.
Hey, Adam and Josh and Sam of Film Spotting. This is Andy calling from Philadelphia, and I just wanted to put in my 2 cents for my favorite comedy of the 21st century. It's Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story. It's just an extremely funny skewering of a genre that really deserves to be skewered, which is the music biopic. It just takes all the conventions and just completely, you know, owns them, gets them right, celebrates them, and rips it apart. And John C. Reilly couldn't have been more perfectly cast, and it's just one of his best roles, which there are many. It's just endlessly quotable, so funny, just gets better every time you watch it. And all I have left to say is one thing. Wrong kid, Dad.
Walk hard, hard down life's rocky road. Walk bold, hard, that's my creed, my code. I've been scorned and slandered and ridiculed.
struggle every day my whole life through. Seen my share of the worst that this world can give, but I still got a dream and a burning rage to live. Walk hard, hard, when they say you're all done. Walk bold.
Just wanted to take a second here to acknowledge some of the generous donations that continue to come our way, especially in light of our recent 600th show milestone, Josh. And we start with a Silver Club donor. You have to take the lead here on this one. It's the Motherland.
Well, it is, but I'm much better pronouncing Icelandic names than Norwegian
True.
Names, but I'll give this a
you've
shot.
You've proven that.
This is Christian Christensen from Porsgrunn, Norway. Just wanted to express my appreciation for Film Spotting with a $60 donation. I discovered Film Spotting earlier this year, and it makes the trip to and from work a joy every day. Your Revenant versus The Hateful Eight debate was a particularly fun episode. While watching The Revenant on the big screen, I caught myself thinking about how much fun The Hateful Eight was. I always have a great time geeking out to Tarantino. Besides watching The Hateful Eight 70mm made the whole thing into a far grander experience. I would also recommend that you or any listeners check out Ravenous from 1999. It's a revisionist Western horror filled with dark humor, great performances from Guy Pearce and Robert Carlyle, and one of the most unique soundtracks I've ever heard. Ebert's favorable review is very much worth reading as well. If you venture back to Scandinavian or more specifically Norwegian films sometime, Pinchcliffe Grand Prix is one children of all ages can enjoy. The great racing scene here was also an inspiration for George Lucas in Star Wars Episode One.
Your beloved Star Wars Episode One,
Josh.
That is
an amazing sequence.
Oh, yeah. That's my exact experience with that sequence. Despite Ebert's favorable review, despite Guy Pearce and Robert Carlyle, who I generally like, I never did see Ravenous back in 1999. I think it maybe was the subject matter. I just knew it had something to do with cannibalism.
That sounds right.
Am I remembering that correctly?
I haven't seen it either. But
thank you, Christian, for that recommendation. We had as well a gold-level donation from John, who says, I've been listening since around 2010. Love the show. I'm from Northern California, but currently live and work in Tamaru, New Zealand. And I probably got that wrong. My apologies. I sent a note in back in 2014 when I saw In Order of Disappearance at a film fest. I loved it and see that it is now rolling out in selected theaters in the U.S. Here we go. Another Norwegian film directed by Hans Petter Moland. It fits in with your current marathon. And John gave us the plot synopsis and he said, basically, it sounds kind of like Pulp Fiction meets Insomnia, the original, of course. And it does have Stellan Skarsgård in it. Pal Ver Valheim Hagen, I should have had you do that, as Grieven, according to John, one of the best villains in years, described accurately in RogerEbert.com by Sheila O'Malley, as a flamboyant villain, a childish psychopath who also happens to be a ponytail-wearing militant vegan.
Yes,
aren't they
all?
I mean, come on. And finally, Bruno Ganz in that film as well. So, Pulp Fiction meets Insomnia. This is a movie, Josh, I did notice just in the past week or so, turned up on my now-in-theaters, available-on-demand via cable at home. So, basically, John is kind of paying us to see the movie. I think we may have to do that.
Comes with a little responsibility here.
Well, we also got a very, very generous platinum-level donation from Chad in Monticello, Arkansas.
Just wanted to congratulate you on 600 shows and figured this was as good a time as any to finally pay the dealer. I discovered your show a little over a year ago, looking for something to occupy my mind on my long daily commutes after moving to a new town, a rural area in southeast Arkansas, where like-minded cinephiles like me are incredibly rare. I Googled podcasts about film and found an IndieWire article listing their best shows about movies. And seeing your show on the list, I decided to check you guys out first. I never made it to the rest of the list, as I quickly found your show to be everything I needed, my own personal oasis. Though I studied engineering in school, and my job now follows that path, I was always passionate about film first, and your show has allowed me to continue my film education with more thoughtful and intelligent discussion than I'm used to. I can't even begin to count the blessings your show has brought to my life. From the vast array of recommendations and discoveries made, I blind bought the Criterion set of the Apu trilogy on your word alone, truly life-changing, to finding kindred spirits in the two of you, despite how absolutely incredibly wrong on some things you can be. I'm looking at you, Josh, on Wolf of Wall Street, The Big Short, The Hateful Eight, Morris from America. You don't quite have a top five there
yet,
Chad. You're going to have to put in a little more work.
I'm guessing he could. He goes on, I'll be eagerly anticipating a pre-order of Josh's book. Oh, somehow he's going to listen to you anyway. Movies are prayers.
There you go.
That way of engaging with movies and culture very much interests me and reflects the way my love of film interacts with my own faith. I must also mention how your love for the work of our guy Jeff Nichols won me over even faster, one of the most vital new voices in cinema. He says a bit of trivia here. Nichols filmed both Shotgun Stories and Mud not far from where I work in the state. P.S. If anyone from Southeast Arkansas is listening, I'd like to send out an SOS here. Help, please. I'm so lonely.
Oh, no.
But enough of my babbling. Your show is a highlight of every week, and here's to 600 more great episodes. Thank you so much, Chad, for the kind and thoughtful words, for the kind and thoughtful donation. And if you do want to support the show, there is a no-cost way to do it. You can rate or review us on iTunes. We've been making a point to do this a little more aggressively recently, and it seems to be paying off with some more visibility there on that platform. And, of course, having more people find the show means more feedback telling us what we got wrong, which is kind of why we got into this in the first place. So here are some quick thank yous to these iTunes users. And we do love trying to make sense of these hastily chosen iTunes usernames. Or maybe they weren't. Maybe they were quite deliberate. C-SJO, TavZ105, Cap'n Pretentious, Globot5000, Silvio99, and Cornello Yellow. They all posted quick reviews over the past week, and I hope they were positive. As much as we love to hear how wrong we are, it'd be great to have a few positive ones in there, Josh.
I think it was Comello Yellow, actually.
And, I like Cornello better.
Between Comello Yellow and Globot 5000, which one do you think actually glows?
You got me.
Comello Yellow.
Hey, Adam and Josh. This is Nate Goss, a longtime listener calling out of the burbs of Chicago, also co-host of the Can We Still Be Friends podcast. And my pick, my favorite pick of 21st century comedies has got to be Idiocracy, the Mike Judge 2006 movie that is, as went viral on Twitter, slowly becoming a documentary. And I remember seeing it for the first time when I just heard it was a new Mike Judge film, hadn't heard anything else about it, and I remember just laughing so hard and not understanding why no one else was in the theater and also why no one else was talking about it. But here we are. And it is becoming more and more relevant and in a lot of ways more and more funny. So that's my vote for top five. And my vote this year for president is going to have to be Dwayne Elizondo, Mountain Dew, Herbert Camacho. Love the show, guys. Keep it up. Thanks.
Thank you. Nate, a great way to kick off officially here. This top five, our favorite comedies of the 21st century. His pick, Idiocracy, a Mike Judge film, reviewed favorably here on the show back in the early days of film spotting. There are some hilarious moments in that film. Alas, not quite make the cut for me, Josh.
Not for me. Very prescient. Absolutely hysterical. Yeah. I honor it with one of my top five picks, I think. So
okay. So we have set up throughout the show already the BBC list that inspired this top five. They were not focusing on comedies. They just surveyed critics. They said, what are your 10 favorite movies of this millennium? So far, they ended up with 103 movies there in that top 100. And what actually really provoked this list was an article I saw probably on Twitter. Jesse David Fox was the writer, writing for Vulture.com. And the headline basically was Comedy Shut Out of BBC's Greatest Films of the 21st Century list. And he made the case, basically, Josh, that yes, there were some comedies on there, like Michael Phillips had on his list, Ratatouille and The Grand Budapest Hotel. Those are funny movies, but maybe not in the same way Step Brothers is
right.
A comedy. So he set out to try to make that right a little bit, and he settled on a couple movies that he thought probably could have made the list if you just focused on those broad comedies, pure comedies, and then threw in, I don't know, eight or nine other dealer's choice options at the end. I'm not going to read those here because our listeners can read them if they want. They can go to filmspotting.net and they can find the link in our show notes. But also, we're going to get to a few of these, I think, as we decided to take up the challenge that Jesse David Fox threw down.
Well, I now understand why I wasn't asked to be part of this BBC voting, because
right.
I certainly would have put a broad comedy on my top 10 list. And clearly they didn't want anyone who would be silly enough to do that. So this was a lot of fun because these are films that, in all honesty, have appeared on my top 10 list over the years,
yeah,
including some of the honorable mentions.
I will get to. There's a very simple reason why I love comedy and value it highly, broad comedy in general. It tells the truth, right? That's all the best comedy does. It gets to the heart of the matter. There's no obfuscation going on. There's no pretentiousness involved. It just takes one great joke or a gag that hits home and bang, you know where things stand. Mm-hmm. So that's what I love about comedies. Not everyone does that, of course, but the great ones do. And those are the ones that I've chosen here.
So this is just one of the many reasons why you're a far more interesting critic than me, because of course I went usually, or I do tend to go with the conventional wisdom. If I was picking my top 10 of this century so far for the BBC list, very doubtful any of these comedies I'm about to mention would have made the cut or really probably been in the top 15 or 20. I don't know. But some of these that are going to get mentioned and are going to get mentioned in the honorable mentions are films that have made top 10s over the years. So it's not like I disregard comedy completely when I put together those end of year lists. Now, before we actually jump in, because we are focusing on those pure comedies, and also because we don't want really to give love to movies that have already been given love on the BBC list, we have decided to rule out a few different filmmakers.
Yeah, we're not going to have the Coens on here. We're not going to have Wes Anderson on here. No Pixar
right.
as well.
And even Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah, you could argue.
Love,
I mean, I think
Boogie Nights is hilarious.
Vice is
yeah.
probably his purest comedy, mm-hmm. if you want to look at it that way. But it's not only that those filmmakers are often lauded and are in fact lauded on this list, but yeah, it's not the sort of going for the comic jugular films that we considered for this list.
Right. And if you were going to create sort of a Mount Rushmore of current filmmakers who make really funny movies, but the types of movies that you wouldn't necessarily label as broad comedies, you'd be hard-pressed to find four better filmmakers than Wes Anderson, the Coen brothers, Paul Thomas Anderson, and Pixar. So that got me thinking, and also going back to our review of Young Frankenstein earlier, Mel Brooks made Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein in the same year. They were both released in 1974. The producers had come 7 years earlier, but just take those three movies in a seven-year span, that clearly cemented him as the comedic director or one of the comedic directors of the 1970s. Someone else you'd put in there? Woody Allen, who's still making films, but who's not going to come anywhere close to making either of our lists. But what I want to throw out to you before we really jump in, Josh, is if Mel Brooks and Woody Allen, let's say, were at the top of the list, the top tier of filmmakers making comedies in the 1970s, and we could probably go through different decades and identify other filmmakers as well, Woody maybe in the 80s too, who would those directors be right now? Let's not talk about film specifically, and this will maybe reveal a little bit of our thinking as we get into our picks, but if you had to right now think of three or four names that you think are synonymous with comedic films, the best comedic films right now. Who comes to mind?
Yeah, this may be a giveaway for some of our lists, but you've got to consider Apatow. I think Edgar Wright may come up for one or both of us. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is I look at the films that I have listed, that doesn't necessarily mean I've got their films on here, but I think they've been consistent. And maybe that's somewhat what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. They're consistently hitting a high level of comedic work. But Apatow certainly, I think the Farrelly brothers, I mean, this was going to come up in my honorable mentions.
In
but
the 90s,
I was,
maybe.
Well, no, I was with them through, I don't know, I think you could say Stuck on You, I still liked
really?
Quite a bit. Yeah. So that's, you know, a long string that
Me,
went
myself,
into
and
the
Irene,
2000s. Yeah.
Not a funny film.
Oh, yes.
No.
Yes. With Jim Carrey.
Wow.
Very good. And then Shallow Hal. There's three there
oh,
from since
film.
2000. That I would hold up as still strong comedic work. Now, they're not in my top five, but I think they were still doing good stuff. Maybe there are other filmmakers I'm missing that you're thinking of?
Well, yeah, you named the first two, and you could go in whatever order of preference you want. But I think if you're talking about comedies, unless you just hate these films and these filmmakers, to overlook Judd Apatow and Edgar Wright would be a little bit ridiculous. And I would throw in there, I think you have to include in that conversation, Adam McKay.
Yep.
And some of his films may come up here, but I think those three are kind of the obvious top tier. I think then, depending on your taste, in that second tier, and maybe they could even be bumped up into the first tier, Noah Baumbach has to be considered when you look at the fact that he's made five or six movies in the 2000s that
yeah.
maybe are not all broad comedies,
he's more
but
Wes
very
Anderson
funny,
style.
But very, very funny movies, and he's made a lot of them. Christopher Guest, he really only has Best in Show and A Mighty Wind that were good anyway
right.
here in the 2000s.
Very strong,
but
though.
I think Whit Stillman belongs in the dialogue, David Wayne. And then you could go to the third tier. And I think these are the up-and-comers who maybe right now have done enough to be part of the conversation, but 10 years from now we'll really be talking about them in grander terms. Lord and Miller, who gave us the Lego Movie and 21 Jump Street and the Lonely Island guys for Pop Star and some other work
for sure
that may come up as well. So with that long-winded preface, we actually get into our picks. Josh, what's your number five?
Let's start with Adam McKay. And I struggled over which option to go with until I remembered just the experience of watching this film. And it has to be Talladega Nights, The Ballad of Ricky Bobby.
Really?
This is the one. I mean, ask me which of my top five films I would rewatch right now. And it's this collaboration with Will Ferrell. It's at the top of their collaborations for me. It's just an improvisational cornucopia. Ferrell and co-stars John C. Reilly, Leslie Bibb, Gary Cole, Sacha Baron Cohen. They take the scenes here swerving in all sorts of directions, and that's appropriate as Ferrell plays a NASCAR star, and they almost always find their way to comic gold along the way and then definitely at the end of these scenes. It's a good thing I believe God has a sense of humor, because otherwise I would be in big trouble for how hard I laugh every time I watch Will Ferrell say grace.
Your tiny Jesus, your golden fleece diapers with your tiny little fat balled up fist pawing.
He was a man. He had a beard.
Look, I like the baby version the best. Do you hear me? I win the races and I get the money.
Ricky, finish the damn grace.
I like to picture Jesus in a tuxedo t-shirt because it says, like, I want to be formal, right, but I'm here to party too. Because I like to party, so I like my Jesus to party.
I like to picture Jesus as a ninja fighting off evil samurai.
I like to think of Jesus like with giant eagle's wings and singing lead vocals for Lynyrd Skynyrd with like an angel band. And I'm in the front row and I'm hammered drunk.
Hey, Cal, why don't you just shut up?
Yes, ma'am.
You know, it's interesting to look back on Talladega Nights after McKay went on to make The Big Short, your favorite film of last year. Speaking of comedies, I mean, you put one at the top there, Adam. I mean, so many of the jokes here have to do with corporate domination of the NASCAR scene or reckless personal consumption, which The Big Short was all about as well. I mean, this is what the foundation is for all the improv going on here. And as I said, they mine it for great stuff. So I really, right now, I just want to skip the rest of my list and go watch Talladega Nights
again. I do need to re-see it because I haven't watched it since it was reviewed when it came out here on the show. It did make me laugh quite a bit, though. My number five, man, we're going to get off to a really rocky start here. I already knew you didn't like the movie, and then now you disagree with the whole premise of me selecting it.
Uh-oh.
But as I went through these choices, I had one criterion. For once, I didn't have some extravagant set of rules. It was just thinking about the films that gave me the greatest quantity and quality of laughs. That's it. I made one exception, and it's this number five, because I had so many in contention for that number five slot, as I'm sure you did as well. At least
absolutely.
Seven or eight that easily could be in this number five slot, that I did consider that Mel Brooks, Woody Allen question. Who probably deserves to be represented on this list, and what's that filmmaker's funniest movie? And I am going with the one we saw together but somehow saw completely different films. It is Noah Baumbach's While We're Young. We discussed it on episode 567. It made my top 10 films of 2015. We talked about it on episode 545, my top five of 2015 so far. And we reviewed it on episode 537. So I really don't have the strength or the will here to try to convince you that it's both hilarious and a little bit profound, but more funny than profound. So I brought in a little bit of help here. Andrew O'Hare over at Salon wrote a great glowing review of the film, and he agrees with me that it's Baumbach's best film. He writes this: if my initial description of While We're Young carries exactly the kind of ironic precision that would be employed by Jamie, the ambitious young filmmaker and male half of the hipster couple so marvelously portrayed by Adam Driver, that's because this movie has the ability to burrow into your brain and affect your consciousness for weeks afterwards. Every time I hear a middle-of-the-road pop song from my own youth in a retail store, I consider whether it's something Jamie would love, the way he loves Eye of the Tiger or Caribbean Queen, John Mellencamp's Small Town, possibly too authentic, Billy Joel's The Longest Time, confusingly doubly retro and also genuinely terrific despite its often irritating author, all the songs on Cyndi Lauper's debut album that aren't Girls Just Want to Have Fun, Bingo. So I love all that partly too because it reminds me of the entire conversation we had with Chuck Klosterman on our 600th mm-hmm. episode, where you could talk about some of this stuff and how it's considered and reconsidered and reconsidered again over the years. But that really spoke to me, Josh, because when I think about this film, I do think about the laughs, but I specifically think about how much I laughed at the scene that I think might be in one of the trailers most people know from the film, where they're sitting there, these two couples, Naomi Watts and Stiller, the older couple, and the hipster couple across from them, and they're trying to figure out the word marzipan, and none of them can think of it. And then finally, Driver just says, let's just not know what it is.
Yeah.
And urges him to not take his iPhone out. And there was just something so truthful about that, that I think about that moment probably at least a couple times a month. I'll have an encounter like that where I'll think about that scene because I'm going through exactly what they're going through, or I'll even say the line out loud to someone when they're about to look something up and they look at me like I'm crazy. But it really has stuck with me, and I do funnel a little bit of how I look at the world and the younger generation through the eyes of Noah Baumbach. One last quick note. I went back to look at my notes from that review. My intro for you, I had the setup that week, which was great because I focused completely on how much the Stiller character spoke to me and I could relate to the movie. My longest intro ever has to be in 600 episodes of the show. I did the math, 100 words longer than your entire written review of the movie.
That sounds about right.
My intro was way longer than your review. So
I think that captures a lot. But, you know, what's funny about this, too, is I think I like every other Noah Baumbach movie.
Really?
You could have gone with The Squid and the Whale. You could have gone Margo at the Wedding, mm-hmm. Mistress America, and Frances High. Both like, I even like Greenberg.
Yeah, but I like all of those.
You have to go with While
For
We're
me,
Young.
For me, the only exception. While We're Young's my favorite. I think Mistress America is fantastic. Highly recommend that, too. The only one for me that's always been the standout in terms of not working at all is Margot at the Wedding.
Okay. Well, I'd call you on this not being a pure comedy, but I might have a bit of a stretch myself coming up, so I can't be too harsh right now. So we got a lot of great voicemails from listeners for this top five. I don't know if it was just that a movie came immediately to mind when they heard about the topic, best comedies since the year 2000.
Yeah, passion for
but,
funny
man,
movies.
Did we get a lot. So let's share another one here from a listener in Kenosha.
Hey, guys. This is Michelle R. from Kenosha, Wisconsin. My favorite 21st century comedy is the much-maligned Freddy Got Fingered. Savaged upon release as the quote-unquote worst movie ever, in actuality, it's both a brilliant real-life prank on the studio system and a gross-out comedy that goes so far it becomes a surreal parody of the same, totally ahead of its time, and clearly presaging modern alt-comedy geniuses like Tim and Eric and Alan Resnick. No movie has made me laugh more.
Oh, look, honey, our boy's a genius. He's rigged a pulley system so he can eat sausage and work on his stupid drawings.
I'm being creative? Now, if you'll excuse me, I still have some work to do.
Daddy, would you like some sausage? Daddy, would you like some sausages? Daddy, would you like some sausage? Sausages, sausages.
So I wish that I could find my original review from the newspaper of Freddy Got Fingered.
I never saw it.
There's a chance I gave it a positive review.
Really? Well, yes. Why am I not surprised, actually, at all?
But this was like, you know, this isn't even in their digital archives, so we'll just have to hope that was the case. But there were things I liked about it. I can at least say that.
Let's just not know.
I like it. Number four for me, however, I am going with Mean Girls, the Heathers, of the early 21st century. It's a broader comedy than Heathers. That one was pitch black, but I think it's as incisive and certainly as influential. Lindsay Lohan is the previously homeschooled high schooler here who's thrust into the social maze of a public school. And Lohan, she's really fresh and funny, if you can remember that, in this film. And you also have, in addition to her, this great supporting cast. Rachel McAdams is the supporting player here as Regina George, leader of the A-list Plastics, and Amy Poehler, so good as Regina's mother, who desperately still wants to be one of the Plastics, or at the very least, be accepted as a cool mom.
Hey, you guys. Happy hour is from 4 to 6.
is there alcohol in this?
Oh, God, honey, no. What kind of mother do you think I am? Why, do you want a little bit? Because if you're going to drink, I'd rather you do it in the house.
No, thank you.
So, you guys, what is the 411? What has everybody been up to? What is the hot gossip? Tell me everything. What are you guys listening to? What's the cool jams?
Mom, could you go fix your hair?
Okay, You girls keep me young. Oh, I love you so much.
Besides the laughs, the emotional accuracy here is just brilliant. Tina Fey wrote the screenplay, and she based it on Rosalind Wiseman's nonfiction book, Queen Bees and Wannabes. I remember feeling that truth when Mean Girls first came out. I wasn't, you know, this was in 2004. High school was, I could still remember it fairly well at that point. Now, though, with my oldest daughter starting her first year of high school, I don't know if I could bear to revisit this whole movie and be reminded of just how complicated that social structure can be. So Mean Girls, my number four.
So now, of course, I'm regretting that we didn't share our picks with each other ahead of time, which we don't normally do, but there are exceptions. And I really wanted to avoid having a pick on your list that I hadn't seen. And despite having a female friend a few years back being aghast that I'd never seen Mean Girls, and I want to see it, I just haven't made the time. She even bought it for me for Christmas, the DVD, and I still haven't done it. No, instead, Josh, going back to Adam McKay and Talladega Nights, you had to convince me that you might go with the other guys. And so I watched that.
You did
in
watch
preparation.
It for
I watched
I
the
love
other
it.
Guys.
And?
I like it.
Good.
I like it. It did. Well, Adam McKay is a great director.
Yes.
I know that
you've
now.
You've come to appreciate that.
But
few
it's
people
funny.
Talk about the other
no,
guys,
it's funny.
But it is up there with their best stuff, I think.
I mean, Ferrell is great. Wahlberg is great.
Thank
All
you.
The scenes with Eva Mendes are fantastic. Everything about that whole dynamic is great. But here's why the other guys is worth seeing, to go off on a little tangent here. For this one scene, the best sequence in the film by far, Michael Keaton plays their captain. Almost every scene he's in, I crack up. But there's one in particular, and I'm trying to remember now. Is it Wahlberg or Ferrell who gets into a fight with another cop at a wake, basically?
Well, and Wahlberg's the hothead, right?
Yeah, Wahlberg's
it's been
the
a
hothead,
while since
so
I've
I think
seen
it's
it.
Him. They get into a fight at a wake.
Uh-huh.
So you have a group of cops standing around
yes.
a circle,
yeah,
just
yeah,
like
yeah.
a
yes.
schoolyard fight. But since it's a wake, they're trying to be quiet and respectful.
So
they're
good.
Like, get him,
it's
but they're
so
whispering,
good.
And then that's funny enough. But then Michael Keaton comes in, and he tries to break it up, and the way he breaks it up by yelling but whispering, I was laughing so hard watching it that I was thinking to myself, they must have done 57 takes of this, because how anybody else in that circle could have watched Keaton do that so seriously
mm-hmm.
and not just lose it. They'd have to be the best actors of all time. That scene is amazing.
See, now you're making me wish I put the other guys on this list. This was hard.
Yeah, it was. So the moral of the story is I still need to see Mean Girls. My number four is a film that came out in 2010. It actually started as a BBC series that was edited into a film. Michael Winterbottom, the director, the movie is The Trip, Coogan and Rob Brydon, where it's these two great comedians and comedic actors playing versions of themselves, for sure, as they go around the English countryside on a trip being paid for, I believe, by The Guardian. Coogan's been sent out, and he can't bring his love interest along with him. I think they've just had a falling out, so he brings Rob Brydon along with him. Now, we really could just play one great scene from all of these movies and shut up.
Yeah,
and
probably
what we should yes. have done here. And I will get to that eventually with one of these picks. But the Michael Caine scene where they're sitting over a meal and they go back and forth over how to properly do Michael Caine is among the scenes that made me laugh the most I can think of, certainly of the past 15 or 16 years.
Well, broadsheet journalists have described my impressions as stunningly accurate.
Well, they're wrong. I've not heard your Michael Caine, but I assume it would be something along the lines of, my name's Michael Caine.
That is where you are so wrong. And you can look at my live video for proof, because that's the very thing I don't do. I say that he used to talk like that.
Do you, Michael Caine?
Okay. I say, Michael Caine used to talk like this in the 1960s, right? But that has changed. And I say that over the years, Michael's voice has come down several octaves. Let me finish. And all of the cigars and the brandy, don't let me finish, can now be heard.
Okay.
I've not finished in the back of the voice, and the voice okay. now. Well, I've still not finished the voice.
You're panicking.
Because you look like you're about to bloody talk. Let me finish. Right, so, Michael Caine's voice now in the Batman movies and in Harry Brown. I can't go fast because Michael Caine talks very, very slowly.
What made me really laugh more than anything in this film, and I noted this during our review back in 2010 when this came out, is watching them when they actually do crack each other up. Because you hear in that Michael Caine scene how they really are kind of fighting with each other in a way. They're trying to one-up each other so much throughout the whole film that when they actually do make the other guy laugh, those are the really rewarding, amusing moments in the film because they're each other's toughest critics by far, and they're brutally honest with each other. So when someone else does something that is genuinely brilliant, well, they have to applaud. They have to give them that. So I love that, but I do also love the way that reality and fantasy line blurs. Again, playing themselves, they are versions, certainly. It's heightened, but it is them, and it's their personas. So the humor comes out of the honesty of a lot of those moments. They're tapping into some genuine antagonism, I think it's fair to assume, that exists between them. And we get those kind of moments then when they go to the cemetery where Keats and Shelley are buried, and they get into a conversation about how they would eulogize the other person.
But of course, let's not remember a man who is lost, desperately trying to legitimize his life by doing silly voices constantly and not confronting the truth. Let's remember the other side of Rob. The Rob Brydon, the entertainer. Yes. The Rob Brydon, yes, who gave some levity, yes, to our life and helped us avoid confronting the harsh realities and helped us avoid looking at the brutal reality of what life is.
Talk about some of the characters.
Oh, so some of the characters. Who can forget his Tom Jones impression? Who can forget that?
Think I better die now.
You can say that.
Think I better die now.
That's good.
Yeah, I know. Well, I'll take over when you're doing it. There'll be plenty of... I'll do plenty of Tom Jones when you're dead. Don't worry about that. Whew.
Funny and brutal and brutally funny. And if you enjoyed those scenes as much as I did and you love the riffing on impressions as much as I did, you can watch more of it in The Trip to Italy from 2014, another movie I thought was hilarious. And apparently, there's a third one coming out. I didn't know it. Spain.
Maybe that will be my chance to finally catch up on these. You've got me here.
Oh.
I never saw The Trip and wanted to correct that when A Trip to Italy came out. Thought I could knock out both. Didn't get to it, so I better get to it soon, it sounds
Sam
like.
Sam actually said, after I told him it was going on my list, he said, yeah, you know what, you've convinced me it's going in my top five as well. He was kind of ruling it out because it really is more of a character study. I said, yeah, but again, quantity and quality of laughs, The Trip has it. So my number four. Let's get to our number three picks here, Josh, but to help us do that, we will hear from longtime listener David L. Williams. He's in Central Pennsylvania.
Hi, Film Spotting. This is David L. Williams from Central PA, and the best comedy of the 21st century is 2009's In the Loop. Armando Iannucci's take on the invasion of Iraq is the funniest political film since Dr. Strangelove. It begins with a British government official saying in an interview that war is unforeseeable and then does everything to prove him wrong. It is dark, acerbic, and laugh-out-loud funny with a fantastically witty script that was nominated for an Oscar. Peter Capaldi's Malcolm Tucker is a force of nature, maybe the most profane character ever put on film, and I'd love to quote some of his lines, but you would just hear a string of beeps. In the Loop is not just the best comedy of the 21st century, it's one of my top 10 comedies of all time.
Yes. Where do you think you are? In some f***ing Regency costume drama? This is a government department, not a f***ing Jane f***ing Austen novel.
Malcolm.
Allow me to pop a jaunty little bonnet on your purview and ram it up the s*** with a lubricated horse.
David is so right about the Dr. Strangelove vibes in that one. I'd actually forgotten that until David brought it up on Twitter and reminded me and looked up my review. And yeah, I did enjoy that
funny
quite
movie
a bit when it came out. My number three is the one that maybe crosses the line a little bit from pure comedy. I went back and forth on whether or not to include it. Unlike my first two picks, I can't say that it ever really made me burst out in laughter, but I was sort of, it had me on a low chuckle throughout.
Okay.
And then eventually that would bubble into an audible laugh here and there. And it was just kind of always on this hum. So I went with it. It's Roy Anderson's Songs from the Second Floor.
I thought about it.
Did you?
I thought about it.
Good. Yeah. That is one we just saw. We just discovered it in our Contemporary Nordic Cinema Marathon. Now, for those who didn't join us on that journey, and you really should, you still can, obviously, in our previous few episodes, we found a couple of gems there. It's been a good trip. This one was a series of droll, absurdist vignettes
We talked in particular about the recently fired office worker who's clinging to his boss's legs as he's being dragged down this cold corporate hallway, as well as the magician who ends up actually cutting into the audience member who he was pretending to saw in half. Now, I described Songs from the Second Floor as capturing the world's last whimper. Yet on my website, where my reviews are archived by genre, I filed it under comedy. So why? It doesn't seem to make sense. But for some reason, and I mentioned this in our review of Songs from the Second Floor, every time that magician's victim would show up in another segment and he'd wince while holding his side, I'd laugh. Yeah. I would just start chuckling. And I don't think it's that I'm cruel. I guess it could be that. But it's more that Anderson has found a way in this movie to take all of the world's collective angst over life's little miseries and how those pile up on us. And he has these characters bear it in a way that makes us laugh. And then by laughing, we feel a little bit of relief ourselves. So maybe stretching things a bit, but I'm going to go with Songs from the Second Floor.
Okay. A film that very well could come up a little bit more when we get to our Nordic Cinema Awards. And yeah, if you haven't watched the film yet and you throw it in because of Josh putting it on this top five list and you start watching it and think, well, Josh is crazy. And
it's a little bit of an
outlier. He's peddled crazy here before. It happens pretty regularly. You might be right, but not only are a lot of the scenes that you just mentioned, Josh, really genuinely funny, if not laugh out loud, it's not about jokes, but definitely absurd and makes you chuckle to yourself. That's probably a good description. I would throw in the two scenes I highlighted during our discussion of that movie. I'll just say the cross convention, the salesman convention, and the scene, I think it's the first one that takes place at the mental hospital with the doctor who is watching this encounter between family members. Those two scenes, those did genuinely make me laugh out loud.
Well, and what's the goal of all the scenes we just mentioned? And I would say probably 90% of the film, the goal is to make you laugh. And I think it's successful. So it may not look or move or sound exactly like the broad American comedies we're used to.
Right.
But it is certainly a comedy.
Well, let's get to some more traditional laughs with my number three. And we're going to get to another voicemail. In this case, Josh, this isn't another option. John in Salt Lake City has my number three pick.
Hey, Film Spotting. This is John in Salt Lake City. My choice for the 21st century comedy is definitely Role Models. It's the most interesting comedy in that that was kind of a dark time because comedy was kind of headed down a really kind of dark, sarcastic, snarky path. And Role Models has that. It's also super gross out and very adult, but it really rises above, and I really appreciated it. It had real warmth that replaced the snark in the face of a really, really easy set of targets. And it was just, I was smiling at the end, and I love it. So that's my choice.
Thank you, John, for that voicemail, and thank you for reminding me just how much I loved Role Models. That is the 2008 comedy directed by David Wayne. He was a co-writer on the film as well. Sean William Scott, Paul Rudd, the stars in that movie. They play two dudes who are punished basically for a few different offenses, and they have to do 150 hours of community service. So they have to be role models for some younger kids. They're the bigs to the littles in Jane Lynch's little program. And a lot of what John said, I think, is dead on, of course, about what makes Role Models a really good and really interesting film, where there is something about the movie that is sweet and uplifting by the end of it. And it works at the end of the film, despite the fact, Josh, that there's still that really strong rebellious spirit to it that we've had throughout the whole film. And we get wonderful moments like a dinner table scene where Rudd finally recognizes in his little Christopher Mintz-Plasse, who plays Augie, a kid who plays those fantasy games and
like Dungeons
goes
and
out
Dragon
Dungeons and Dragons.
Stuff, yeah.
He's got the swords and all that stuff. Well, I think Dungeons and Dragons just takes place all in your head, doesn't it? He's actually full-blown dressed up.
I don't know how into it you can get.
We are losing our nerd credentials here, Josh. But that's a wonderful scene, and there are lots of little wonderful warm moments in this film. That all said, it's hysterically funny because of scenes like this one.
What you drawing there? Oh, Beyonce. She's smoking.
I don't want to take my pants off.
What? Whoa, whoa.
All right, Ronnie, that's enough.
This bitch tried to grab my joint.
Language, Ronnie.
My language is English. And this mother tried to grab on my hang down.
I, Got my own hang down to touch, kid.
Hope he has one of the handful of my balls.
Porky, that's racist.
Well, I trust you two will work this out. I'm not going to micromanage. Not my modus operandi.
Now, I don't know how much of that scene we were actually able to play on the radio or how much we had to bleep, but hilarious stuff. Sean William Scott proving in this film and a few others that we probably didn't fully appreciate him after all being introduced to him as Stifler in the American Pie movies, because he's really a legitimately good comedic actor, really funny guy.
Oh, yeah. A movie that almost made my list, The Promotion, which he's in with John C. Reilly. He absolutely holds both the comedy and the dramedy there. I'm glad you went with role models, though, for the Wayne film. I think the one that you'd most often hear is Wet Hot American Summer. People just have such a relationship with that picture. But I enjoy Role Models probably the most of his. And Wanderlust, too, is really, really strong. So he is one of those names in that tier you were talking about at the start of our list.
Well, then it worked out very well that I reached out to David Wayne, and I thought, as one of those directors in one of those tiers, we should get his perspective on his favorite comedy of the 21st century. And I did not see his pick coming. Let's hear it.
Perhaps it's generational, but for me, there haven't been so many classic pure comedies in the 21st century so far along the lines of my all-time favorites, including The Graduate, Tootsie, Woody Allen's best ones, Animal House, Pink Panther, Airplane, Flirting with Disaster, etc. I think part of it might be that a lot of the real creative energy in narrative comedy these days has moved to TV and to the web. With that said, if I really think about what movie made me laugh the most and hardest this century, I'd have to go with MacGruber from Yorma Taconi and Will Forte. Unabashedly stupid, yet obsessively tight and crafted under the surface. Honorable mention has to go to the Jackass movies, which also had me laughing hard from beginning to end, even though it's kind of cheating. And final honorable mention goes to Tommy Wiseau's unintentionally funny movie, The Room, which is the only movie I've ever seen that elicits giant roars of laughter on nearly every line of dialogue.
Well, I guess if David Wayne has gone out on this limb already, it's safe for me to go out and say that I really like the Jackass films, too.
Yeah, no, I do as well. At least one of them was reviewed here on the show and favorably. But I'm with David. Thank you for that wonderful voicemail, because it prompted me to do more homework. No, didn't watch Mean Girls, but I did watch MacGruber in preparation for this list. And he's absolutely right. It's hysterical. MacGruber is a really funny film. Did you see it, Josh?
I still need to see it. I'm going to do it before I see Popstar.
Smart. I think that does make sense. Directed by Jorma Taconi, who is part of that Lonely Island group. And I thought Popstar was really good and really well directed and well conceived all around. And you can go back to MacGruber and see that he certainly knows what he's doing. Popstar wasn't an anomaly at all. And just real quick, I have to say my favorite line in the movie. MacGruber, who has been out of civilization for like a decade and is a huge dork to begin with, so isn't really in touch with anything cool. He drives this Mazda convertible, this red Mazda convertible that he thinks is like a hot car, and everybody makes fun of him for it. And he's got one of those old car stereos that he takes out when he gets out of his car.
I had one of those.
Oh, yeah, I did too. So it doesn't get stolen.
Uh-huh.
But he takes it to another level, Josh. Like, he pulls up to talk to someone and just gets out of the car and is standing behind it. He pulls the stereo out. If he walks into a restaurant or a party, he brings it with him. It doesn't matter where he's going, which leads to the best line of the film when some bouncers destroy it. He says, "That is a Blaupunkt. You owe me a Blaupunkt."
Well, it was one of the better brands.
Exactly. That's why it's funny. And that concludes Adam Does Lines from MacGruber. Let's get to your number two.
Cedar Rapids.
Knew it was coming.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, think about it this way. Some of our best comedies turn on minor moral dilemmas. Think of Jack Lemmon's, C.C. Baxter, In the Apartment. I'm talking your language here.
You are.
I see Cedar Rapids as working in the tradition of a movie like that. This is pretty much what we've got. Ed Helms plays Tim Lippy, a mild-mannered insurance agent who's sent to his first business convention and is shocked, just shocked. He can't believe how regular people behave when they're away from home. Helms is so good here. I'm not going to say he's Jack Lemmon, but really his naivete and the way he commits to it and his excruciating normalcy, I think, is something we don't often see mm-hmm. on screen. We see nerds or we see guys who are idiots, but just to see a painfully normal everyday guy played like this is a rarity, and he still manages to be funny while doing it too. The movie, though, is almost stolen by its supporting cast. We have Anne Heche, who is revelatory to me in this movie.
She's
never
great.
Thought of her mm-hmm. this way before. She plays a married mom who's looking to have her own sort of fun at this convention. And then John C. Reilly, who, if it's not clear by now, I consider a comic national treasure.
Yeah.
He is the convention's notorious partier who tries to turn every year into Mardi Gras.
Who wants to get wasted? Juju!
Oh, how about check out those studs? Woo!
Joe Ostrowski Fox.
Oh, Ronald, you look fantastic.
This one, ugh, it is. Squeeze it to death, you little firecracker! Oh, you sweetheart.
Oh, so good. Oh, Lippy. My lippies are sealed.
You know this guy?
Oh, that's right, from the fitness center.
Yeah, I was really naughty with you down there. I'm really sorry, too.
Oh, no, she's not.
Oh, no, I'm not. Oh, shots! Let's do it. What do you want, guys?
Jaeger time.
What's really unique about Cedar Rapids, I think, is the level of complications that it brings to this morality play. Again, like The Apartment, when Tim gets embroiled in the convention's annual awards ceremony, he finds out how corrupted they are and kind of gets caught up in it. It's actually these misbehaving new friends who help him find his moral compass. So it's not one of these bad behavior comedies that lets its characters run wild for 90 minutes and then hypocritically tries to punish them. This is so much better than that. So once more, I'm going to bang the drum for Cedar Rapids.
And I can't complain about that as much as I'd like to, because I really like Cedar Rapids quite a bit. And I especially like it if it's the de facto super obvious Larson choice for this list, and it means that I'm not going to hear the words Casa de mi Padre with your number one.
We've got another pick. What are you talking about?
Just trying to lay the groundwork here, Josh. You have an out if you want to take it. But I like the comparison as well to C.C. Baxter, because it's interesting that in that movie, Jack Lemmon starts out as a pretty nice and seemingly decent guy who nevertheless has to figure out how to be a mensch. And Tim Lippy is a mensch already from the mm-hmm. very beginning. He's a really good guy who's getting more and more corrupted as the movie goes on. My number two is a movie I haven't seen since it came out, so I can't say how gut-bustingly funny it is. I don't really remember, but I do remember just thinking it was so consistently clever. It is, and when I see scenes from it or I'm prepping for a list, I'm always reminded of that, and it comes from one of those top-tier directors, Edgar Wright and his Shaun of the Dead. I have said this on the show before, of course. I have never been a big horror guy, so it wasn't a case where I watched Shaun of the Dead and thought, wow, I've been looking for this movie that was going to send up horror films or sure. be a send-up of zombie movies. And thinking about it, I go back to Young Frankenstein a little bit. We talked about how the accuracy of that movie and how it really succeeds because of how lovingly they pay tribute to movies like the James Whale Frankenstein. This is another case of that, where it's not Scream, and Scream's a perfectly fine movie, but that's one that's just overtly self-referential. All the jokes are based on our understanding of horror movies and their tropes, and a lot of the humor comes from you getting those references. But this is a film, Shaun of the Dead, that works completely on its own as a buddy movie, as a pseudo-thriller, as a sort of coming-of-age movie, certainly as a character study, and I think that can be said of all of Wright's films. The other thing I like about Wright on this list, and why I wanted to make sure he was here, this is also something that's come up a few times over the past couple of years on the show, is how, I think, safe to say, unlike all the others on this list, he is, as a director, a visual humorist.
Yeah.
The editing, the pace of the cutting, the types of cuts, the shots themselves, his use of space, what's in the frame and what's outside the frame, what we know is there, but sometimes a character doesn't. That's where a good chunk of his humor derives, and I think we need to be sure to praise filmmakers like that who are really using the medium and not just writing a lot of really funny jokes or funny scenes.
That's absolutely right. It speaks to a little bit what I was mentioning to Michael Phillips about maybe why the BBC list didn't give more credit to comedies, because they're not always this formally inventive. But it also makes me wish I could have revisited each of these films on my list and think about them in those terms
right.
and really study them that way. I think maybe Songs from the Second Floor is the one that absolutely uses composition for gags. We talked about the comparison to Jacques Tati
right.
when we reviewed it. So that is
definitely a strength, something that Edgar Wright has in his toolbox. And I'm glad you went with Shaun of the Dead. I think if I – that's what I would have gone with. If I didn't go with it, it's probably because it does work so well just as a horror film too,
and
you know?
I thought about that. I almost wrote it off for that reason, but a lot of listeners mention it, and I do think it is about the humor first and foremost. I think that's true with all of his films, despite what else we get from them. And to that point, I will mention that sort of like what I was saying with Role Models – this is a movie that has really sincere moments amidst all the humor,
absolutely.
But more extreme, right? On both ends of the spectrum, the humor is way more absurd, I'd say, than anything, of course, that we get in Role Models. But there's nothing in Role Models anywhere near as emotionally raw as the standoff in the pub, where these friends have this standoff and they share a lot of really dark hidden truths or things that have been unsaid. And then Sean has to make a decision involving his mom that's legitimately heartbreaking in this spoof of zombie movies.
Very
it's
much drawn from the zombie
pulls that off.
Tradition as well, and they make that work. Yeah, it's a really strong film. All right, we're at our number one picks. No, it's not Casa de Mi Padre. Sorry, Adam. It is one that I share with Eddie from Austin, so I'll let him make the pick.
Part of me badly wants to go to that for Idiocracy or Jackass number two, but I'm going to have to go with the one that also features the best comedic performance, I think, which would be Borat, which, you know, say what you will about the scripted parts, it's, you know, totally hilarious start to finish. And there's the thing that puts it over the top for me is that the palpable sense of danger you get from some of those scenarios that Baron Cohen puts himself in. And it's just tremendous. I cried laughing at least three times watching it the first time, and it still makes me laugh just as hard each time. Good luck with the list. I hope you guys find room to agree with me, and have a good one.
I am with Eddie and Michael Phillips, incidentally, who mentioned Borat as one of the comedies he might have picked for this list. In that Vulture article we talked about that inspired the list from Jesse David Fox, he writes this. So first, Borat needs to be on this list and probably top 50. Not only is it inventive in its blending of completely fictional and real-world elements, but Sacha Baron Cohen created a brilliant, loudly hilarious title character and fully realized universe for him to live in. It is both the greatest satire of post-9/11 America and a love letter to the country. Borat was, of course, Sacha Baron Cohen's tour of America in the guise of a boorish Kazakh television reporter. And then in these stunts and these interviews that he would do with actual people, he would hilariously and cringe-inducingly expose the intolerant underbelly of contemporary America. I think you could argue that Borat is even more timely. If he visited the America of 2016, I don't think he'd be as much of a fish out of water. Maybe when he's randomly kissing strangers on the subway, yeah, that wouldn't fly.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of these scenes, he wouldn't stand out as much. His brand of intolerance is more openly spoken in just these few years. I think you can thank the internet for a lot of that, and you can also thank this year's election climate. So if you were to rewatch that infamous speech he gives at the rodeo and the crowd's reaction, tell me this couldn't be mistaken for a Trump rally.
Yeah.
My name is Borat. I come from Kazakhstan. Can I say first, we support your war of terror. May we show our support to our boys in Iraq. May USA kill every single terrorist. May George Bush drink the blood of every single man, woman, and child of Iraq. May you destroy their country so that for the next 1,000 years, not even a single lizard will survive in their desert.
So that phrase Eddie used, palpable sense of danger, that is really there in that scene and a lot of them in Borat. So for that and, you know, honestly, also for the naked wrestling scene, Borat is my number one 21st century comedy.
Well, it's a really good pick, and it's a movie that I remember reviewing favorably on the show. I remember laughing at it quite a bit, but I also remember there's just something about it that didn't sit well with me. There was something about some of the provocation. Maybe it was that it felt too forced, and I honestly don't know. I'd have to go back and listen to what I said or look in my notes or revisit the movie, but I just remember feeling like some of it was not only too forced, but some of it was mean-spirited in a way that differs from the other types of mean-spirited moments in the film. There's a distinction between some of them versus the other where maybe it's that the subjects are in on the joke, or sometimes the subjects are more worthy of his scorn. Others don't seem to be.
It's sort of the Colbert Show and Daily Show dynamic, right?
Yeah.
Where those interviews, you're always wondering, what did they know beforehand? So that's definitely an element. And I remember having a bit of that experience as well. I also think, though, that Borat is not a movie that you should come out of feeling comfortable. I mean, it should disturb you in some way. I know you're probably talking about a little bit of a different way, but it is meant to provoke and put you in a state of unease.
For sure. It's one I need to revisit for sure. Okay. My number one is a film from a director who came up in our discussion of the top tiers of current comedic filmmakers. And I really strongly considered Judd Apatow's Knocked Up for this list. I remember seeing that critic screening and losing my mind laughing at it, but I have to go back to the film that I think, if you look, he'd had some success as a producer with Anchorman in 2004, but it really was, I believe, 2005 that The 40-Year-Old Virgin came out, the movie that really gave us, I know he'd been on The Daily Show, but the movie that gave us Steve Carell comedic genius. And this scene, I said sometimes you can just play a scene and you don't really need to say anything else. That's what I'm going to do here, because there were a lot of really funny moments in this movie, but this dialogue, this conversation, the guy's night out, I think they're at the electronics store they work at that's always playing Michael McDonald music in the back room, and they're playing cards, and they kind of force Steve Carell to share his sexual experiences.
I dated this girl for a while, and she was really a nasty freak. She just loved to get down with sex all the time. She was like, any time of day, she was like, yeah, let's go. I'm so nasty. And I'd be nailing her.
Oh,
she'd be like, oh, you're nailing me. Cool.
She talked dirty to you?
Oh, she loved to dirty talk. Totally into it. She'd be like, yeah, let's screw. I want to. God, it was so dirty. She'd be like, oh, me so horny, me love you long time. So.
I remember seeing that for the first time and convulsing with laughter. That's how funny I thought it was. And of course, we only could play a little snippet of it there, but pure broad comedy, huge laughs. This was a no-brainer for me, The 40-Year-Old Virgin.
And it probably is ridiculous that I don't have an Apatow film on this list. I think I may be punishing him because his run has been so good and I don't have a clear fire favorite among them. I mean, between Trainwreck, Knocked Up, and this, love them all. This Is 40 is the only one that, Funny People.
I really like Funny People as well. I know.
And so it's not fair, but I'm punishing him because he's been too consistently good. I guess I can't just pick one.
Fair enough. Those are our top five comedies of the 21st century. Josh, before we get to some honorable mentions, let's allow a couple more of our listeners to honorably mention some really funny movies.
Hey guys, this is Kenny Meyer from Boulder, Colorado. Congratulations on 600 shows. Sorry I didn't get a chance to call in for that one, but calling in about 21st century comedies, got to give my vote to 2009's I Love You Man with Paul Rudd and Jason Segel. It's kind of in the same vein as the Judd Apatow, Seth Rogen, James Franco movies, but with some real heart, some real empathy for the main character, who is a guy who has always had girlfriends, never had any guy friends. He's getting married and he doesn't know who to ask to be his best man. And hilarity ensues as he seeks out guys for mandates to make friends. And he meets Jason Segel, and the quotability of that film stays with me today. I still say things like, I got you programmed in my hyphen, and totes my goats. And I really actually think it's changed the way people talk. Anyway, so love you guys. Have a great day.
Hey, Adam and Josh. This is Griffin in Chicago. Big fan of the show. Calling with my response to your question, the best comedy of the 21st century. you might consider this a bit of a cheat. I know you're looking for pure comedies since it's maybe considered a music doc or concert film first, but my answer is definitely Dave Chappelle's Block Party. The music is amazing. As it unfolds, the movie takes a weird shape, following Dave through small town Ohio and then a dilapidated mansion of two elderly Brooklyn artists, but he holds the whole thing together. Spending the time with him in this movie is such a joy. He's so warm and natural and funny. I love this movie so much, and I wanted to recommend you guys consider it. All right, thanks.
So one that was completely off my radar, but a movie I have seen and enjoyed, Griffin's pick, Dave Chappelle's Block Party, and then Kenny Meyer going with I Love You, Man. That is a funny, funny film.
Indeed it is, and an honorable mention for me. As a matter of fact, of all the movies that have been mentioned so far on this show, I think the only one I'm not on board with is While We're Young.
Mm-hmm.
So consider those all to be honorable mentions,
okay.
But I'll give you a few more that I don't think have come up at all. Team America, World Police. We had a recent poll involving that. I think that is as applicable today as Borat or Idiocracy, which Nate Goss suggested, and I agree with. I mentioned The Promotion. Barbershop, I was a big fan of. Very broad comedy. Lots of laughs in there. David O. Russell's I Heart Huckabees. I'm one of the few fans of that one.
No, I like it.
Did you? Okay,
I mean,
good.
Wouldn't come anywhere close to making this list, but
no,
I like the movie.
Honorable mention, though. Do Love Nacho Libre. Year of the Dog, a very underseen gem with Molly Shannon.
Oh, man.
It's worth
that
checking out.
That was a huge, huge split back on a show where Sam and I went to Sundance, our one trip to Sundance together. Sam
and?
Loved it.
Oh, you were on the wrong side.
I hated it.
Oh, well. One more here, Spike Lee's Bamboozled. Just a blistering satire along the lines of last year's great Chirac, equally ignored.
Equally ignored because it's nowhere as good as Chirac.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you like Chirac that much.
I do like Chirac, but I was definitely very mixed on Bamboozled, a film that has some really good stuff in it, without a doubt. Here are the seven movies I'm going to mention, and a couple of them have been mentioned. And yes, I'm only going to say seven because not only did you have some great picks that I think are really funny, and we've heard all these great voicemails, you're right, we could go on and on and on and list 25 films that are really funny from these past 16 years. But here are the ones that I definitely strongly considered for my list. Knocked Up, Juno.
Yeah.
I think people forget how funny that movie was or didn't want to think it was funny enough anyway. I've said this before. I know there was a lot of hype when it finally came out in December, but when it played at the Toronto Film Festival for critics in a large movie theater and I knew absolutely nothing about the film, once it got past that really almost disastrous opening scene with Rainn Wilson, I had one of the most enjoyable experiences I can remember having at a theater, an entire theater of 1,000 people laughing in unison at that film.
That's true. And yet it's also so emotionally resonant,
mm-hmm.
at least it was for me,
right.
that I don't think of it as broad of a comedy as some
and
of these others.
That is why I ultimately moved it into the honorable mentions. Along those lines, In Bruges, Easy A, I think definitely qualifies as a comedy. Best in Show. You mentioned Team America, World Police, and then another one that just seemed like it was a tough fit, and I was already going with one Michael Winterbottom film, The Trip. 24-Hour Party People is another movie that is full of humor. It's a great Steve Coogan performance. I think of it as a lot of things in addition to being a comedy, so maybe that's why it didn't quite make it.
Didn't Steve Coogan, did he do Tristram Shandy with Winterbottom? I would consider that a
you
comedy
liked,
as
and
well.
I did,
yeah.
too. So you could go a lot of different ways with Coogan and Winterbottom. I think he belongs in that dialogue as well about some of the best comedic directors of the 21st century. We want to know your picks, maybe some of your favorite directors, but those films in particular that made you laugh the most over these past 15 years, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
Or send us a voicemail. We had a lot of great ones on this show. We can keep it going. Let's make it a regular thing. You can leave a voicemail at 312-264-0744. If you miss that number, it's under the About Us tab at filmspotting.net. We're also on Facebook and on Twitter. Adam's at FilmSpotting. I'm at Larson on Film. Also at FilmSpotting.net, you can find 11 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. And if you haven't already, please check out the FilmSpotting family of podcasts, The Next Picture Show and FilmSpotting SVU. You can find both of those in iTunes or whatever podcast app you use.
Out in limited release. Other People, this is Jesse Plemons starring as a gay comedy writer who returns home to take care of his sick mother, played by Molly Shannon. Molly Shannon in this one, I like this movie better than You're the Dog, Josh.
You've seen this?
I've seen this.
Oh,
I did catch up with it over the weekend, and I'm still wrestling with my reaction, but I like Plemons a lot. I like Shannon a lot. And I do think there are a lot of really nice moments and some really funny moments as well. Out in wide release, The Disappointments Room, a mother and her son release unimaginable horrors from the attic of their rural dream home. It stars Kate Beckinsale. When the Bough Breaks, Wildlife, an animated film, the Robinson Crusoe story told from the perspective of the animals on the island he washes up on, and the latest from Clint Eastwood, his movie starring Tom Hanks, Sully. We do hope to get to Sully at some point, if not a full review, maybe a few comments, but we do have plan right now our very special Oliver Stone extravaganza with critic and author Matt Zoller Seitz. His new book, The Oliver Stone Experience, comes out next week, and he's going to share his favorite Oliver Stone moments, and we'll talk Born on the 4th of July as well.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.